You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Francesco Duina, who is a professor of sociology at Bates College. He is the author of several books, including Winning, Reflections on an American Obsession. We are going to talk about his latest book, which I highly recommend and am extremely grateful he's gone out and produced. It is called Broke and Patriotic: Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. Francesco Duina, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So I guess describe for us the sort of dilemma or seeming contradiction that led you to do this research.
Sure. Well, there are several reasons that led me to it. I think the primary reason is that one would imagine that the citizens of the United States that have the least in terms of financial resources would at the very least have some sense of resentment or tensions towards their country. And instead, what you find is that by essentially most measures of patriotism, or we can define that later, but you know, love of country, or even a sense of that the country is superior to other countries, it's the best country in the world, you find that, in fact, they score very, very high. They score higher than the poor in other advanced nations,
right.
And they score higher than a little bit higher than working class and middle class Americans. While at the same time, of course, you know, by most measures, their future looks very bleak. You know, they have the least intergenerational mobility of any other set of poor people in other countries. So the chances that their kids will achieve the American dream are very low. Historically, also within the United States history, very low.
Right.
And, you know, wages and hours worked and Social Security benefits. And so the question was, why are they so patriotic when so many things in their lives would lead to perhaps somebody thinking about, well, maybe they shouldn't be. Maybe they should be asking questions and wondering why they love the country so much.
And you didn't try to figure this out in your office. You went out and interviewed lots of people, poor patriotic Americans in Alabama and Montana, right?
That is correct. So what I did was I spent time in both of those states for various reasons, primarily because statistically speaking, those are hotbeds of patriotism among the poor in the United States. I mean, you could have gone to any state of the Union and find out that over 90% of poor Americans are highly patriotic. So it wasn't difficult to pick two states. Any two states would have done the job, but I wanted to pick two states that were especially high up there and also different from each other, so I could hear different spins and perspectives. And I spent time in laundromats, bus stations, used clothing stores, homeless shelters, the streets. I spoke to 63, turns out, Americans. For about each person was probably around, I know it was close to 45 minutes on average. And, of course, recorded them and, eventually transcribed them. I came away with about 1,000 pages of transcribed text. So that's what I did. I went to urban centers as well as rural areas, of course. And I varied in terms of respondents by gender, by race, by religious orientation, by whether they had served in the military or not, by ethnicity, you know, all the kinds of measures you would think might make a difference for the kinds of stories that they would tell.
And it seems that you'd found some variations across demographics and between those two locations, people in Alabama grateful to the government for helping them a little bit, and people in Montana grateful to the government for not helping them at all. But largely you found agreement. You found the same sort of beliefs leading to people's patriotism, right?
That is correct. So the there were some differences, of course, and differences also along race. For example, I found that in many ways African Americans in the South were the most patriotic, especially the older African Americans, which surprised me considering the history there and their history there.
Sure.
As well, of course, yes, large differences, significant differences in terms of stories between Montana, sort of libertarian spin there versus Alabama, as well as, you know, rural versus urban questions of hunting and gun rights came up a lot in rural areas. So there were differences, but certainly the themes that came up, whether because I would have certain questions I would ask them sort of prompt, like, what do you associate with the flag, or because we got deep into the conversation, ultimately the same themes would emerge from our discussion, and I was able to weave them together into three or four general narratives, if you will.
And can you tell us briefly what those were?
For sure, yeah. One is that that America is the land of freedom, and this was sort of the most obvious one, the one that I expected the most. And it concerned both physical freedom and mental freedom. So it wasn't merely a question of I'm free to think what I want and do what I want, but also I'm free to move around and to go from one place to the next without feeling any worries, without feeling that I'm constrained.
Yeah.
So that was a big one, and, you know, even to the point where I met a young fellow in Montana who told me that, he was homeless by choice, and it was a sabbatical from life, and lived in the field, and
right.
Slept in the field. And, when I asked him about that, he would say, well, you know, in America I can do that, but, you know, in other countries I would be sort of herded off and, you know, brought to jail, you know.
Yeah,
of course.
I was going to say I was a little surprised, I admit, by how much so many people talked about the freedom to move around, as if in other countries you can't move around. And it struck me that it sounded like they were describing freedom from prison, but they always talked about it as freedom from dictatorship, freedom from living in a dictatorship. But it seemed like their reference mm-hmm. point really was what is so common in the United States, mm-hmm. Incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, you're right. The primary, one of the main reasons was sort of freedom from dictatorships and people watching you and telling you where to go or where you cannot go. However, there were a few who said, look, if I commit a crime here in the United States, I go to jail and I'm out in 3 months. Whereas, this is a different kind of discussion we can get into maybe later. They would say, well, in Germany, you know, they cut your tongue off. Or in
right.
Saudi Arabia, if they catch you, they chop off your hand. And so I have a...
But one of those is insane and the other one is actually true.
That's right. So one of the things that, in hindsight, after spending time there and chewing on what I had heard and talking to people about this book, I kind of realized was that in many ways the respondents held on to beliefs that sometimes were true, you know, and sometimes were not true, and that they juggled these things in their minds seamlessly, you know, and they... That this contradiction that they have, right? About even if I would push them towards them, you know, I would say, well, you can hunt in Canada too. You don't have to be in Montana to be able to hunt, right? It's not the only country in the world where you can hunt. They would kind of balk at that a little bit, but then they would sort of do some mental gymnastics and say, well, true, but here it's really enshrined in our documents. Right, our legal documents, and so I feel like it's more protected, it's more real. Uh-huh. And so there was a lot of course, misconceptions, which I talk about, but also, you know, sophisticated, I would say, in some ways, you know, juggling of contradictions and then resolving those contradictions. But keep in mind, you know, I ask them questions that they, most of them had not really thought about too much in advance, right? So it was sort of impromptu conversation.
I think you were very generous and very forgiving and very respectful in your interviews and how you described them. But these are people who told you that in Canada they've got health care, but it's a dictatorship. And in Russia they'll cut your tongue out. And in communist Japan they'll cut off your head. And in Sweden they give you free college, but everyone flees the minute they graduate from their free college. I mean, isn't there – don't you get a sense that there's some willful self-deception going on here?
Well, that's a good question, right? So in a way, you could argue it's willful self-deception. But on the other hand, you have to think about the order of importance of these thoughts for them. These were not thoughts that came out first when I spoke to them.
Uh-huh.
They were thoughts that would come out when I pushed them to think about these things. And so they were not, in the order of things, they were not at the top of their mind. And of course, if I pushed, all these kinds of misconceptions, you know, came up. But at the same time, I would say, I mean, is it willful self-deception? Yes and no, right? We all tell stories about ourselves and about our countries. Most national narratives are deceptive, whether it's Japanese national narratives or French national narratives or what have you. And this is just one national narrative, which happens to, in this case, and I would say in the case of most Americans, actually, happens to of central importance for self-definition, for the degree to which they use it to define themselves. And so it's a central element of their identity.
Well, I wasn't suggesting Canadians never delude themselves, and I wasn't suggesting that I never delude myself. But it seems that the poor in the United States are a little more patriotic, and they're also a little more religious, and they don't really, in many cases, draw a line between the two. I mean, they told you that that God favors the United States over every other country, right?
That's right. That's right. That was very prevalent. I know that in your work you talk about that too. And certainly they said that. That was a very dominant theme that, you know, God loves everybody, but loves the United States a little bit more because of the United States' history with religious freedom, because this country was supposedly founded by people who were fleeing from religious, you know, persecution. And because the people of the United States historically have paid a lot of attention to God and tried to please God. And so that was sort of the narrative. And there was also a personal narrative that they would come up with that had to do with, you know, I by the way, personally am in touch with God. I speak to God every day. God has saved me, you know, from my troubles. And or a great line that I heard, you know, was God gives you double for your trouble from this poor woman in African-American woman in Alabama in a homeless shelter, you know, who was an aspiring artist, but, you know, an elderly woman. And yet she would say, there are great things for me, you know, I had for me, which is another theme, a theme of optimism that I heard that was linked to, that was linked to America, you know, that was linked to, I'm optimistic, and I'm optimistic because, you know, this is the land of milk and honey, which is another great theme, one of the two or three great themes I heard, which is this is the land of milk and honey, and just because I have failed, right, just because I have failed, that doesn't take anything away from the country, the greatness of the country.
Right.
And that's a very important point because people already know this from statistics and so on and so forth, but we know that Americans in general attribute their life trajectories to themselves and not to outside variables, which for a sociologist like me is sort of very counterintuitive, right?
And did you inform them that other wealthy countries have greater upward mobility, that they have?
Yeah.
And then what do they say?
Yes, towards the end of the interviews, you know, the discussions, they became discussions, and very personal and emotional discussions often. You know, I would say, but all these things you tell me, many of them, I could tell you that you would be better off in Sweden or France or Spain even, you know, you would. And so, you know, why do you hold on to these things so much, you know? And then they kind of got lost a little bit there. They say, well, but I've never been there, or I've been there a few times and I didn't like it. Or, well, yes, but, you know, are those countries premised on, I'm paraphrasing here, David, right? But basically, sure. They would say, are those countries premised on an explicit social contract that recognizes the worth of every individual and the possibilities of individual self-determination?
Yeah. Know the founding documents, right? It really is the rhetoric, whether it was ever intended and whether it's ever been adhered to. It's the myths of the founding rhetoric of the United States that they love.
That is correct. And you can't, you know, I mean, they're not, you know, wrong about that. I mean, they're somewhat wrong. There are other countries that kind of have similar things, but very few countries on Earth, you know, were started as countries, effectively, with an explicit, on the foundations of an explicit social contract. Because, you know, if you think of India, China, any European country, maybe even France, even though they had a revolution, there was a country there before, and then they came up with contract.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, maybe Haiti, there are a few examples, you know. You have the beginning based on an abstract set of principles, right? And they knew those principles. And they, I should say, they also differentiated, and this is something that I kind of dawned on me afterwards, after even I wrote the book and all that, just talking to people about it. And I would have stressed it more in the book, they differentiate between the nation and the state. So not only do they take personal responsibility for their, you know, life trajectories, good or bad, but they also say, look, you have to differentiate between the government, what governments have done, and what the nation is about, what the, you know, the founding documents are about. Of course, the government and the state has not always lived up to the founding document. That's for sure. And African Americans were the first ones to tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
But like Martin Luther King, we need to recognize that the documents are in fact excellent, and we need to go back to those documents. And so that narrative also came up, and their ability to say, yeah, the government may not be doing great things, a la Montana, for example. That's what I would hear. But the nation is the key. And so,
but if the government bombs another nation, it's doing right, and it's doing an act of philanthropy. It's these wars on Iraq and many other countries are benefiting those countries, whether they're grateful or not. It's generosity. And then the other countries are described as inferior to the United States, often because they're at war. Even if it's the U.S. military engaged in those wars using money that these people actually need, that's a sign of inferiority of those other countries, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, they weren't – we can pick, you know, their logic a lot, you know, and in many different ways. Of course, yes, they would attribute effectively what you're saying is they were attributing – the negative qualities of some of those countries to those countries, whereas in fact they may very well be reflections of things that we have done to them, you know. But, you know, they would say, well, considering history and considering what other countries have done to other countries, we have been a benevolent empire on the whole. And they didn't use those words, but, you know, in general, when we go in, with ideas that are, you know, it's kind of like when Hillary Clinton bombed Libya, you know, Gaddafi.
Sure.
And as always, what they point to is, you know, it's not us doing it. We are doing it, but we're not doing it out of our own self-interest. We're doing it because we're enlightened with these universal principles of human rights and protection of minorities and all of these things. And unfortunately, it falls upon us to make sure that those evil dictators out there don't abuse their people and deprive them of those rights. It's almost like a duty that we have. Right,
right. Right. Because who would destroy Libya if we didn't do it?
Right, exactly. And so it's actually a sacrifice. Like you said, generosity. And that's another theme that, of course, came up a lot, was America is the most generous country on earth. America is the land of milk and honey, but also abundance in the world. It just overflows with goodness, you know.
Yeah.
And these are people who have served. These are people where people die in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are not, you know.
Right.
You know, they contribute to the military more than the other economic class
sure.
in the United States.
Right.
So they, you know, and yet they would say, well, you know, we did it because we are a great nation and recognize these universal truths, right? And so that, you see, gives them a sense of dignity.
And then they tell you that other countries have no due process and good legal system. They're savage. They commit right. public executions. And right. then some of them turn around and right. support public executions.
Yeah. That's right. There was one person in particular, I think you're referring to, a really remarkable sequence there where he went on and on, you know, about that. And then he said, well, you know, but... Well, I would ask him, what would you do? Well, you know, we still should drag him out and hang him in public, you know?
Right.
Make the, you know, because even if, you know, if they rape somebody, wouldn't that's the right way, you know? But then I would say, well, what about due process? And they would, he would say, well, I mean, after due process, then you do that. So, of course, you know, contradiction.
So this is why I think, you know, education might help and being better off and more secure and safe might help, but it's largely a religious belief. It's not, you know, something arrived at through logical, rational thought. And I think there's even a parallel to U.S. racism, right? I mean, mm-hmm. white Americans for centuries could think, well, at least I'm better off than the non-white people. Everybody in the United States now can think, well, at least I'm better off than the non-Americans.
Right. Right. And I mean, the religious part is very important. You know, there is long-standing research that suggests, that argues that, you know, America's religion is the civic, it's civic commitment, it's civic culture. There is no God, you know, as far as God is concerned, it has to do with civic stuff. Nationalism is America's religion.
Right.
And that, you know, and that's consistent with what you're saying. And I would add to that the fact that, you know, there's a subsequent question, which is, but why don't they hang on to something else? Right. I mean, maybe one day I'll go to other countries and do the same exercise and ask there what they, you know, and I know that they won't be as attached to their national identity.
Right.
And so why is that the case? Well, I think part of the answer has to do with the fact that culture in the United States is a younger country, right? A thinner, if you will, a thinner culture.
Yep.
And in a thinner culture, you can't hang on to, there's not much to hang on to. The one thing that's really thick is this sort of sense of nationalism. You know, as you pointed out in your work, you say, well, there's flags everywhere, national anthems everywhere, and pledges of allegiance. Exactly. Because if you didn't have that in a country of this size, with the history that it has had, with the youth that it has in terms of history, what else are you going to hang on to, right? What else is going to give you a sense of purpose and dignity and order and, you know, like that? And, well, this definitely can do that for you. It gives a direction and a sense of priorities and a sense that you, because of the content of it, it also recognizes, you know, you as a worthy thing. The contract itself is an interesting contract. I mean, the people I spoke with, I remember very well, said, you know, I have nothing, but I have the worthiness of an individual as recognized by the founding father. So I am as worthy as the president. And then he said, in fact, I met the president. I was serving in, I think, in Vietnam, and there was a big dinner for Thanksgiving, and there I was with the president. What country gives you that? What country gives you the recognition of worthiness as a person, regardless of your money or status in other ways?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is powerful stuff.
We're going to have to figure out an answer to that in smaller communities or in the global human identity or something. Because, you know what, we've just got about 3 minutes left. What I think would be interesting, I'm sure you're working on something else now, but I would love to see a similar book on slightly more wealthy Americans, mm-hmm. because it seems that you know, you ought to resent the creation of poverty and suffering, whether it's impacting you yourself or not. And the patriotism is only slightly less among wealthier Americans than it seems that what you've already learned probably applies in slight variation to everybody in this country, wouldn't you think?
Well, that's a good question. The numbers are very similar. You know, in the end, instead of 95%, say 87% or something like that, depending on the proxy that you use to measure it. But I think the content of the narrative would vary a little bit. So when they say freedom, when a poor person says freedom or the land of milk and honey and generosity, they mean one thing. Mm-hmm. I think when a richer person says freedom or the land of generosity and you can make it here, they mean something different. And so I think that the kind of the casing would be similar, but I think the content would be quite different, just like it was different for African-Americans in the South mm-hmm. vis-a-vis, say, whites in the South or, Native Americans in Montana. So the language, the thread is similar, but then when you open it up, you see that it's sort of filled in with different stuff. And
yeah.
I actually think it would vary.
I wonder what, assuming that you agree with me that it might be useful to reduce the patriotism, what do you think, what pieces of information, if people really knew what Scandinavia was like, rather
right.
than imagining people flee when they get their degree,
right.
because, the Washington Post found that people favor bombing a country in direct proportion to their inability to correctly place it on a map.
Wow.
Right? So what particular pieces of information do you think might be helpful to people?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Education for sure would work. I think that maybe it would be both specific content, but also a little bit of toning down of the national rhetoric,
Yeah.
We don't need to have the Pledge of Allegiance. My kids recite the Pledge of Allegiance every morning.
Yeah.
There's a flag there's a national anthem play for every basketball. What does the basketball game have to do with the national anthem, right? There's a lot of that stuff, right?
It's a good question.
But the thing about it is that the modern world is built that way, one way or another. There isn't really an answer to that question. We still live in a world of nation state. And so we're kind of trapped in them. I would love, if you sense it correctly, I would love for there to be a world without nation. But how that would be substantively configured and how that would work is a different question. But definitely, nationalism is a big problem in many ways, but it's the case, it's the content, it's the frame in which things happen. So it's a difficult question, man.
Well, this is a wonderful book that raises difficult questions. I highly recommend it. We've been speaking with Francesco Duina. The book is called Broke and Patriotic, Why Poor Americans Love Their Country. Go out and get it. Francesco Duina, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It was fantastic. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Americans, many of them anyway, have been filled with outrage and anger and sadness at the fact that immigrants escaping violence and deprivation, some of it visited on them by U.S. policy and practice, are being treated as criminals at the U.S. border. Children being literally pulled from their parents' arms and locked up in pens. And it's all in aid of what exactly? The truth is, U.S. policy on immigration has long veiled, thinly, in abject cruelty and racism. And so while outrage at family separation at the Mexican border is a fine starting point for a movement for change, it cannot be its end. We'll talk about bigger, positive visions on immigration with Jacinta Gonzalez, senior campaign organizer at Mi Gente, the national political hub for Latinx organizing. Also on the show, corporate U.S. media coverage of Haiti, as with many places, is inconsistent and shallow. But the shallow coverage of Haiti is especially ahistorical and disempowering. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. You hear that a lot. ABC's George Stephanopoulos once described the country's problems as biblical. But they are, in fact, political, social, economic problems that have identifiable roots, and the international community has a big role in them. So now, when you hear that protests over a hike in fuel prices in Haiti are causing chaos, you should know there's much more to it. We'll talk about that with Jocelyn McCalla, longtime director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights, now advocacy coordinator for Haitian Americans United for Progress. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Images of weeping toddlers torn from their stunned mother's arms, of children in cages, or what some insist you call chain-link fenced holding areas, and of three-year-olds representing themselves in deportation or asylum proceedings, these have outraged and galvanized many Americans in protest of the Trump administration's racist, cruel, anti-immigration and anti-immigrant policies. Outrage is justified, but if we intend to translate it to substantive change, we're going to need to build out from this immediate visible crisis to connect it to all of the other factors and actors that make today's headlines possible. So what now for those who recognize family separation of immigrants to the U.S. as no outlier, but part of a broader social agenda that goes well beyond the U.S.-Mexico border? Our next guest has been organizing against immigration enforcement and the criminalization of Latinx and immigrant communities for years. Jacinta Gonzalez is senior campaign organizer at Mi Gente, the national political hub for Latinx organizing. She joins us now by phone from Phoenix. Welcome to Counterspin, Jacinta Gonzalez.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, families belong together has broad appeal as an idea. Broad surface appeal, if I may say. Even media who are trying hard have had trouble finding people to give a full-throated endorsement of the idea of pulling children from their parents who are trying to enter the country. That is beyond, well, they brought this on themselves, you know. But the power of positive messaging aside, is it your sense that families belong together is just not a sufficient organizing principle for bringing about the real change that we want to see? How do we need to grow that idea?
I think what we saw clearly with this newly created crisis by this administration is that when we simply demand things like family unity, what we get is family unity behind bars. And so for us, it was really necessary to be able to raise awareness of not only what was happening with the devastation of young children being separated from their parents, but also with the criminalization of migration and mass prosecutions of folks who are entering this country. Because with this analysis, we're able to actually make demands that would get to the root of the problem instead of just treating the most horrific, but yet the manifestation of the actual policy.
Right. Well, in your very straightforward piece, How to Stop Child Separation, Stop Sending Their Parents to Prison, that you wrote last month for Truthout, you talked about, you know, if we really want to go forward from this and we want to use our very warranted feelings of upset and anger at what we're seeing to really end the crisis, there are a number of elements of that work that we could be looking at. What are some of the things that you're pointing to that folks might direct energy to?
We put out a policy platform that kind of describes that there's both movement demands that we're making, but there's also really concrete things that both Congress can do, different government agencies can do to try to get us a little bit closer to the real solution to some of these problems. For us, a primary demand or a central tenet is the abolishment of ICE as an agency. We know that family separation has been happening not only at the border, but also when deportations are taking place and parents are being separated from their families, but also community members more broadly are being separated from their loved ones and from people that they share their lives with. And so we think that ICE as an agency should be completely abolished, which means there should be a moratorium on deportations. There should be a defunding of the agency. We should end all forms of detention. And those are very concrete demands that can be accomplished now. But we also point to the need to decriminalize migration. You know, the laws that are on the books that are allowing Jeff Sessions to throw the book at people are laws that were written in the 1930s by a legislator that was openly advocating for lynching, that was against interracial marriage, and that promoted the criminalization of migration. And so it's time for us to take a strong stand and decriminalize that as well by taking away Section 1325 and 1326 that allows for these prosecutions to happen.
I think we did start to see maybe an advance over the conversation that we had around DACA and the Dreamers, which was very much about let's not punish these innocent children for the crimes of their parents. And it was this very invidious and kind of confused understanding of what crime is and of what it means to try to isolate. I mean, to me, it reminded me, frankly, of the welfare reform conversation around 1996, where we had media talking about, yes, let's punish these lazy mothers, but how do we protect their children? You know, it's a very kind of artificial conversation. But I feel as though things have maybe moved on a little bit from that to where we can see a distinction between crime and criminalization, you know, making things a crime. I don't know. Am I too optimistic there? Or do you think people are starting to understand what it really means to criminalize immigration itself?
I think we see tendencies going both ways. Mm-hmm. So I actually think there's a lot of things that are really exciting about seeing people broaden their analysis of criminalization and their understanding of policing, understanding that immigration and customs enforcement and border patrol are policing agencies. And so that a lot of the same critiques that can be applied to ICE also apply to the police. And so it kind of broadens the conversation and the possibilities of what we can do and what kinds of alliances we can build, particularly between Black and Latinx communities. But you also have, I think there's a tendency in the center to try to say that this is not the time for radical demands that actually give different possibilities, that we should say things like, well, we'll give you the wall, but legalize this many people.
Right.
And I think we've seen a couple of rounds of that. You know, we had legislators saying that they would negotiate with Trump on some of these policies, knowing full well the far, far right-wing agenda that he's pushing. So I think we also have to see the opportunity of being able to have more people understand the criminalization. And I think we also have to be wary of not taking advantage of this moment because it's unveiling what the system truly is meant to do. And so these are the moments where we can actually provide other options and alternatives to folks beyond what many mainstream Democrats have been presenting as solutions.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about that vision. The International Red Cross just released a report talking about the new walled order, as they put it, and saying that criminalizing aid and public services for immigrants and migrants is setting back advances by a century. And what they're calling for is just a simple separation from immigration policy and from those policies regarding access to food and health care and legal advice. You know, so they're also applying it to the French mayor who said that distributing food at a migrant camp was illegal, and the Italian government that's saying NGOs can't go out into Libyan waters with search and rescue missions and all of that. I feel that that international vision is necessary to, you know, broadening the context of what's happening at just the U.S.-Mexico border, which you've just indicated is really not only about the U.S.-Mexico border. But I think an international vision and a bigger picture of migration worldwide would help here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have to have a broader vision of migration because, you know, migration has been happening for centuries. And given the increases in wealth disparities and the added crisis of climate change, we're going to be seeing more and more of it. And unfortunately, for a lot of countries, the response has been a militarized criminalization of migration that is creating a worse human rights crisis, but also creating economic incentives for people to try to continue to promote an agenda of dealing with it that increases countries' ability to incarcerate, to surveil, to police. And so I do think we have to understand this within the broader context and also understand it, again, within the framework of if we continue to have a system that responds to everything with punishment and criminalization, we're going to continue to confront this better over and over again, and not just in migration. You know, we're seeing it with reproductive justice issues. We're seeing it with climate justice. We're seeing it with the legal justice system that this country also uses. And so I think we have to have a broader analysis that connects all of those dots.
Well, let me just bring you back finally, if I could, to the idea of abolishing ICE, which I think is fascinating. I've heard it said, you know, it's one of those things that is presented as, well, you can't get rid of a government agency, even if it's an agency that only recently came into existence. And part of what I hate, frankly, about corporate media is the way that they try to limit our political possibilities, you know. So abolishing ICE is the kind of idea that the corporate media will tell us is laughable and impossible until we do it, and then they'll act like they invented it. And I just wonder, how do you encourage people to think around the ideas and the limitations that they're getting from news media, for example, and do the work outside of that and get beyond of that? I feel like, you know, work that occurs outside the media lens in some ways is free from some of the limitations that media try to present to people about what is possible and what can happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, your idea is being taken seriously when a former Department of Homeland Security chief is saying that it shouldn't be promoted as a policy demand.
Right.
You know, there is those processes where, well, we're in an actual conversation about it, which means that it is possible,
right,
and could be done. And so I think it's important to grapple with that, or to, you know, to use that energy in the moment that is there. ICE as an agency was only created with the purpose of detaining and deporting people. It was, in fact, designed as an agency to terrorize immigrant communities. And so I think that it is very possible and realistic to get rid of it. There are a million other agencies that help in different parts of immigration laws in this country, and you don't need ICE to be able to do the other functions. So I think it's very possible to completely get rid of it, have a moratorium on deportations, defund ICE as an agency, restructure resources, and there doesn't have to be a replacement. I think we have to be very concerned with people who are advocating that it be readjusted and housed within the Department of Justice. I think we're seeing the worries of what can happen with the Department of Justice, who that is only aimed at incarcerating people. Housing our immigration policies there would only make that worse. So I actually think we have to be able to reimagine different structures. And I think what we're seeing is that also the American public has an appetite for it. We saw it with the most recent victory of different congressional representatives that are running in New York. But I think we've seen it with over 100 candidates coming out publicly to support the demand. So I think we're also seeing that we're able to do it as a policy, and it's a platform that people will vote for.
Well, let me just ask you finally if you have any thoughts in terms of media coverage that you'd like to disappear right now, but also some that you would like to encourage, that you would like to encourage reporters to do more of on this issue as we go forward.
I do think that it's important to continue to do reporting on what is happening with the Department of Justice and migration. We saw the first impacts of criminalizing people who are crossing the border, but we're going to see a higher and higher uptick in people being prosecuted for other types of things, like working without documents or coming back to be with your children here. We're seeing that more and more the Department of Justice and Jeff Sessions are promoting an agenda to lock as many people up as possible. Migration is one component of that. The war on drugs is another component of that. The war on dissent is another component of that. These are all agendas that folks are moving from Washington, D.C., that have long roots in white supremacy, and they need to be fought back against, and they need to be documented, because we can't realize what's happening until it's too late, and communities are serving year-long sentences as a result.
We've been speaking with Jacinta Gonzalez of Mi Gente. They're online at migente.net. Her article, How to Stop Child Separation, Stop Sending Their Parents to Prison, can still be found at truthout.org. Jacinta Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mount Juliet Mission Group stalled in Haiti. Missionary from Hubbardston weathers protests in Haiti. Riots delay Lowell missionaries' return from Haiti. Raleigh Church Group returning from Haiti after civil unrest. Judging by headlines, one might assess that the significant thing about public protests in Haiti, particularly Port-au-Prince, is that they have interrupted the travel of U.S. missionary groups. Reading further, you may learn that the immediate spark for the unrest was a proposed hike in fuel prices, a 38% increase in the price of gas, 47% for diesel, and 51% for the kerosene many people use to heat and cook. But in general, the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles was a notable exception, big U.S. media outlets just don't seem all that interested in what's happening in Haiti, and so stories focused on Americans who tried to help but got caught up in violence take center stage, reinforcing a media storyline that has tended to present Haiti as a place of almost inherent chaos and a bottomless pit for international aid. It's a sad, static vision that doesn't encourage much thinking about positive ways forward for Haiti and Haitians. Joining us now to help shed a different light on things is Jocelyn McCalla, the longtime director of the National Coalition for Haitian Rights. He's now advocacy coordinator for the group Haitian Americans United for Progress. He joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome to Counterspin, Jocelyn McCalla.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I understand that there had been news of this fuel price increase before July 5th. It was not a total surprise. And the fuel hike, which the government subsequently rescinded, is really only one of a number of things feeding frustration among many Haitians and between many Haitians and the leadership of President Jovenel Moïse. What more is there to this situation that maybe we're not getting from news reports?
Well, that is absolutely correct. Frustration with Haitian government policy has been building up for quite a long time. So the announcement that fuel prices were going to be hiked to what many Haitians believe are an acceptable level, essentially tipped things over, and Haitians express their frustrations visibly with street demonstrations and taking their ire against several businesses that had set up shop, not in the capital city of Port-au-Prince, which is what a lot of media is reporting, but in its outlying suburb of Pétionville, which in fact has become the economic center of the Haiti since the 2010 earthquake. So let me very quickly run through some of the issues that Haitians have faced over the last several months. The government has lavishly spent on itself and very little on basic necessities and basic social welfare, schools, education, hospitals. A lot of the people working in the public sector have not been paid in several months. They basically live from hand to mouth and essentially have to borrow money or live on credit. And the fact is that their debt and their obligations are increasing while the government has done nothing to alleviate their distress. That's one issue. The second issue is that for months, people have been saying, given the rate of inflation in Haiti, which has been quite high, cost of living has gone up, and there has been demand for wage hike, which has been completely ignored. So in fact, when people compare the price hike for the gas and what the wages would deliver, it's essentially on the same par. So most Haitians live on about $3 a day. I mean, if they're employed, they get about $3 a day. And the gasoline price hike would rise to about $5 a gallon, which meant that for a worker who has a steady job, it would become nearly impossible to save any money or bring back any money to home where they could feed their family. Those are the kind of things that rarely get in the news, as you mentioned earlier. The third thing I would mention is that when I said, for example, that the Haitian government has lavished the privileges upon itself, they've also, they and their own associates have engaged in several land grabs using the power of government, using their authority, using brute force to essentially kick people out of the property. In fact, a week before the price hike, or perhaps even less than that, the president ordered several dwellings near his home to be destroyed. People were just given a few hours to essentially leave everything behind, leave the property that they had behind, and very quickly bulldozers came in and destroyed their homes. And all for, and allegedly, the fact that the president wanted to build a heliport so that he could avoid the huge traffic jams that are now a daily occurrence in Port-au-Prince and in Pétionville. So those are the kind of things that the Haitians have been frustrated with. So when the government basically said, hey, listen, we're going to raise the price of gas, everything is going to be costing much more, and the fact is that it's going to lead to the IMF and the World Bank and other international financial institutions to provide us with money so that we can cover our costs and budgetary costs, normal routine budgetary costs. People basically said, this is not going to happen. This is silly. This is unacceptable, and we're not going to have any of it.
Well, I read a quote from a former prime minister saying that because Moïse didn't have a strong, structured opposition in front of him, he thought he had the political capital to impose an unpopular measure. So what can be said about other forces? Is there a sort of counterforce to the machinations of Moïse within the Haitian government? Who can people look to?
Well, I think a lot of the structured political parties have become weaker, in fact, as it has been reported. But I think that the part of what Mr. Moïse and his acolytes in government seriously underestimating is the frustration of people who are essentially tired of being taken for granted, tired of bearing the cost of poverty and being mired in poverty for how many years, and whose only exit out of this might be, if it comes to pass, leaving for better refuge abroad. A lot of Haitians have migrated to Chile, to Brazil, to the Dominican Republic. They're making their way out of Haiti, which is unfortunate because what happens here is that Haiti is losing some of its best able-bodied people to migration.
Well, let me ask you finally about the diaspora. When Donald Trump made his vulgar and insulting comments about Haiti, along with other countries where black and brown people live this January, and apparently specifically asked, why do we want people from Haiti here? Your response at the time was to say, Haitians in the United States should keep your eyes on the prize and don't get distracted. What are some of the things that you mean by that? And has Donald Trump changed the experience or the feeling in the Haitian community here?
Well, obviously, Donald Trump's putting down Haitians in the most vulgar terms has essentially made Haitians realize that if they're going to fight for their rights in this country, that they're going to have to stand up and they're going to have to organize themselves in such a way as to pick up the struggles that, in fact, led to the growth of the Haitian community from the 1970s on. To a certain extent, the policies being carried out by the Trump administration today are no different from policies that Haitians experienced themselves in the 70s and the 80s. There was a Haitian program. The kind of attitude, very negative attitude against Haitians prevail was in the 70s as well, because basically you had people in what was then the INS. Biggest thing that we don't want these Haitians here. We don't want them. We don't want these black people, which in fact led to a lot of the civil rights groups in this country to take up the Haitian struggle and their struggle for asylum and refugee rights. But this said, the fact is that when we said that people have to keep their eyes on the prize, that meant, one, organize yourself. Two, Mr. Trump is not the last person, you know, who's got a say on this. I mean, there are other institutions in the United States and that have say in what will be eventually the immigration policy of the United States. I mean, obviously, the president has a lot of power, as the Supreme Court has indicated, in defining what immigration policy is. But the fact is that what we have here is a situation in which, as people organize themselves, as people structure themselves to fight back, we've seen the government push back on policies as well. So that's why we say, you know, keep your eyes on the prize and organize, organize, and organize.
We've been speaking with Jocelyn McCalla of the group Haitian Americans United for Progress. They're online at haupinc.org. Jocelyn McCalla, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and their transcripts on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. And the website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
With heat records already crashing around the world, scientists are predicting an El Niño this winter. It's time for this Radio Eco Shock replay on El Niño and everything it means, first broadcast in 2014. Will 2018 be the hottest year in human history? Will the Pacific Ocean changeup called El Niño startle the world? I'll speak with ocean climate expert Shane McGregor and report on the situation along with my surprising conclusion. But stick around for the final interview. We'll go from fear to action with Luke Kimmel and the Leaf Ninjas. They are transforming a city one backyard at a time with success in urban agriculture and neo-green job creation. Luke has good tips for you. But we start with the story of the day, El Niño, first with the latest report from NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They issued a new update on El Niño this past Thursday. Mike Halpert serves as the acting director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland. He's co-authored articles on climate variability and prediction. He's worked with ENSO and seasonal forecast teams. Mike Halpert, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome.
So what is the latest prediction from the National Weather Service about whether we will get an El Niño?
Today we issued our latest ENSO diagnostics discussion, and we continue to be issuing what we term El Niño watches. So it means that conditions remain favorable for El Niño to develop. Probably the biggest update to this is that we're more confident at this point that El Niño will develop at some point. With the probabilities now exceeding 65% during the summer months.
Yes, we had a problem in 2012 when it looked like an El Niño might shape up, but then it didn't. Are we finding better ways to make these predictions?
You know, really the models and the statistical tools haven't really changed that much over the past few years. I think one of the things that gives us maybe a little more confident that this year El Niño will develop is that the incipient factors, what we're seeing below the surface of the ocean, are considerably stronger than what we saw in 2012. So even though we did peak out at a 75% chance that El Niño would develop back in, I guess that would have been in the fall of 2012, we're seeing a stronger setup at this point. So we're a little more confident that El Niño will develop.
And there are a range of possibilities for El Niño, from sort of weak to strong. Do we have indications on that?
You know, at this point, that's still premature. We are really still in what we term the spring predictability barrier, or basically this is still kind of the minimum time of year for historical skill. Having said that, like I said, the subsurface is quite favorable for El Niño to develop, so we do think that will happen, but strength-wise, we're probably still a couple months away from when we'll have a better handle on that.
Why should Americans care whether an El Niño arrives later this year?
El Niño has really global impacts. It's such a disruption in the atmospheric circulation over the Pacific that really the impacts ripple globally. For the U.S., should El Niño to develop over the next couple of months, it could certainly have an impact on the upcoming hurricane seasons. In particular, El Niño oftentimes helps to suppress hurricane activity in the Atlantic Basin. So that would be a good thing for those folks living in coastal areas. Of course, it still only takes one hurricane to get you. So whether you have fewer total storms, you still have to prepare if you're living in an area that's susceptible to tropical cyclone activity. Or once we kind of get through the hurricane season, the next real significant impacts over the United States would be next winter. Oftentimes, El Niño is associated with wetter than average conditions across the southern tier of the U.S., in particular from Texas to Florida, but in the strong cases, oftentimes in California. And obviously, given the very strong and severe drought that's ongoing right now in California, I think a nice rainy season next winter would certainly be quite welcome. We oftentimes also see milder conditions across parts of the U.S., in particular the northern parts. And again, I would say after the winter that we've just experienced in those areas, they might be appreciative of a break as well.
I'm wondering, too, and I know the weather's becoming more unpredictable, as the recent report from the U.S. government tells us, but could an El Nino bring a relief from that sort of polar vortex winter that we had last year in North America?
You know, that is kind of hard to say. Those are two phenomena that are kind of maybe work on different atmospheric phenomena. If you go back to the last El Nino we saw, which would have been in the winter of 2009-10, it was also one, while we didn't have the severe cold, it did see a lot of snow up and down the East Coast. And that really was kind of a combination of the El Nino providing the enhanced storminess down to the south and a different phenomena, something called the Arctic Oscillation, being in its negative phase, which allowed cold air to infiltrate the central and eastern part of the nation, and combined with that moisture resulted in quite a snowy winter from the D.C. area northward.
There's a new article in New Scientist, actually it's an editorial, saying that governments should be preparing people for an El Nino. What sort of preparations can we take anyway?
You know, some of the simple things that a homeowner might do if you live in an area that's likely to see or potentially will see heavy rainfall could be simple things like clearing out your storm drains, clearing out your gutters to make sure that the water that does fall on your roofs runs away. If you're thinking, if it's about time for a new roof, if you're living in California, well, it might be appropriate to get it before the winter rather than after. There was actually a fairly remarkable comparison to the two big El Nino events that we've seen over the past 30 years, the 1982-83 event compared to the 1997-98 event. Back in 82-83, the El Nino was really unforecast and caught everybody by surprise. 97-98 was clear due to advancements in monitoring as well as models that we were going to see a very significant event as early as the summer months. Word was provided out to California and really much of to the U.S., but in particular California, they did some estimates and they claimed that the early warning and preparedness that they were able to do before the rains came in 97 saved them roughly $1 billion compared to the losses and damages back in 82-83.
Does climate change have an impact on El Nino? I mean, they've been happening for thousands of years, but has climate change, will it change it?
You know, that's an open question at this point. You're right. El Nino, you said thousands. I think some people say El Ninos go back tens and hundreds of thousands of years. So El Nino has certainly been a part of the normal cycle of the Pacific Ocean. At this point, there's no evidence that El Nino is changing as a result of climate change, but it is still something that we're looking at fairly closely.
So what will scientists be watching for in months to come?
Well, for those of us that track and predict El Nino, we'll certainly be looking for the surface to continue to warm. It has warmed modestly over the past month or two. If it continues to warm at some point in the next couple of months, we'll probably go from our El Nino watch to issuing El Nino advisories. But what will play the largest role in the development in this event will be how that above average ocean water starts to interact with the atmosphere above it. If we start to see the winds and the patterns of sea level pressure, and in particular the patterns of tropical rainfall start to shift as well, that's when we'll be quite confident that certainly we're going to see an El Nino that will have impacts, and then we'll have to look out and see how strong it potentially could become.
Where can listeners go to get further updates on El Nino?
The Climate Prediction Center website, www.cpc.noaa.gov, is a good starting point. It's where we issue our ENSO discussion. We also have weekly products. We're also in the process of developing an ENSO blog that will be hosted on the NOAA Climate Portal. That's actually just climate.gov, and there should be a link up probably either later this week or early next week. And on the blog, we'll be providing some kind of news and features, but also it'll be an opportunity to interact and even answer some questions that folks out in that have climate interests and concerns would like to provide to us.
Our guest has been Mike Halpert, the acting director of NOAA's Climate Prediction Center in College Park, Maryland. Thank you so much for the update, Mike.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, reporting on the quiet panic about the coming storms, El Niño, what it is and what it isn't. Then stay tuned for positive steps from the Leaf Ninjas. Maybe you heard that a system called El Niño could further destabilize the weather and ring up another record hot year globally. The last big El Niño was in 1998, one of the hottest years on Earth, and a time of storms and firestorms in many parts of the world. The next may arrive soon. Scientists have been working furiously to find out how this weather system works. They also want to predict when an El Niño is coming. In the heart of that hunt is Dr. Shane McGregor. He's a research fellow at Australia's Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Dr. McGregor, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the new science, let's cover a bit of the basics. What is El Niño?
So I think to understand El Niño, you need to first understand kind of the background conditions of the Pacific Ocean. So basically, the winds in the Pacific Ocean blow from east to west. Okay, and this causes a whole bunch of warm water to pile up in the western equatorial Pacific, and it makes the eastern equatorial Pacific quite cold. Now, during an El Niño event, that warm water that was normally piled up in the west sloshes back across the Pacific to the east and makes the whole equatorial Pacific east and west very warm.
Right, but then that becomes a complex system that appears to affect the rest of the world. So why should we care about what happens there in the Pacific? And why are governments and scientists racing to understand El Niño?
To answer the first part first, why do we care? The main thing is, so atmospheric convection, or like large-scale rainfall, occurs over the warm water. So when the warm water is piled up in the west, you have a whole bunch of kind of rainfall occurring in the western equatorial Pacific. During El Niño, when you move that warm water east, this rainfall kind of moves to the east as well. And in terms of the tropical Pacific, this rainfall is very important because it basically acts to fuel the atmospheric circulation cells. So basically, we're moving where we're putting this fuel into the atmosphere, which then in turn changes the atmospheric weather patterns around the globe.
And are there major and minor El Niño events?
Well, there's obviously like a whole spectrum of events, you know, so you can slosh just a little bit of the warm water from the west to the east, and you can slosh kind of all of it over. So there are definitely different magnitudes of events. And the interesting thing is there's kind of a distinction between the small ones and the big ones, and it's basically during a small one, you move the rainfall, the equatorial rainfall, from the west to about the central Pacific, and it's not warm enough to actually shift it the whole way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific. Whereas during the big El Niño events, the rainfall systems move from basically from New Guinea and can extend the whole way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific, so almost the South American coast.
Okay. Now, for me, an important point is that since the last big El Niño in 1998, we've spent 16 years pouring even greater record amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and at least half of that, we're told, is absorbed by the oceans. Can these added gases and heat add up to an even bigger El Niño event than we've had in the past?
So it's really hard to kind of specify one particular event as being due to global warming. You know, so El Niño events are a regularly occurring natural phenomenon that have been occurring for hundreds, even thousands of years, according to paleo records. So it's really hard to just say one individual event is going to be enhanced or dampened due to global warming. So, yeah, I can't really answer that question specifically saying, yes, this one's going to be super big because it's El Niño. But there has been some research saying that the chances of getting big El Niño events is going to increase as we move to a warmer climate.
Well, for the science, I'd like to begin by asking about a recent paper that you co-authored, and the title is Late 20th Century Emergence of the El Niño Propagation Asymmetry and Future Projections. Shane McGregor, what did your team of authors hope to do with that paper?
Okay, what we hope to do during El Niño events, and the way they have been observed in the past, most of the sea surface temperature changes start out in the eastern equatorial Pacific, and then they move to the central equatorial Pacific, whereas the really big El Nino events of 1982, 83 and 97, 98 started in the central to western equatorial Pacific and moved eastward towards the west coast of South America. We set out to explain kind of why that happened, why those two events were so drastically different to the other ones in terms of their propagation characteristics. And then we kind of looked into what would happen to these kind of events in the future in regards to how ENSO is simulated in the climate models used in the current generation of IPCC models.
So in a language that someone without scientific training could understand, what are some of your conclusions?
The conclusions were that basically the events get so big, the current anomalies on the equatorial Pacific, like the surface winds, generally go from the east towards the west. For La Nina events and small El Nino events, the current anomalies still go that way. But for a big El Nino event, the changes in the currents are so strong that actually reverse these mean currents on the equator. And it's that fact that causes these events to propagate from west to east instead of from east to west.
So it's really a change in the current in the ocean is what you're saying?
Yeah, basically.
Well, now let's say I'm a government leader or an advisor. Does this new research help me prepare, or can we even prepare for such a big change in the global weather system?
That's a difficult question to answer. So in terms of just in forecasting El Nino events in general, one of the good things about them is, so basically the events are kind of starting to get initiated in the Northern Hemisphere summer is when the events will be initiated. They peak in the Northern Hemisphere winter, so around Christmas time they'll reach their peak magnitude, and then they kind of decay in the following spring. So once an event has started, you have a good idea how the event will play out. So regardless of the magnitude, you know the sea surface temperature anomalies will generally continue to grow until Christmas, and after which time they'll decay. So it gives why scientists are so interested in it. It gives us the ability to kind of enhance forecasts, so seasonal forecasts of rainfall and temperature for various regions.
In the Northern Hemisphere, say in America, we would start to look for this to build, say, in September and then peak in December. Is that what I'm getting from this?
Yeah. But so basically, so what we're seeing so far to date, I'm not sure if you're aware, they're actually anticipating or forecasting, you know, a 70% likelihood for an El Nino event to occur this coming Christmas. And what basically happens at the moment, there's kind of the initiation of the event appears to have been started. There's been these kind of big wind bursts in the equatorial region that have basically started sloshing the water from the west towards the east. Once the water gets to the east, it requires the atmosphere to respond to the changes in sea surface temperature, and then this acts to further enhance the changes in sea surface temperature. So it's kind of what we call a positive feedback. So once this positive feedback starts, and once you can see that it's actually happening, which should take place in the next several months, we should be there to then have a lot more confidence in our forecasts.
Well, let's follow up with a second letter published this past January in the journal Nature Climate Change. It's exactly what many of us worry about. The title is Increasing Frequency of Extreme El Nino Events Due to Greenhouse Warming. First of all, how would you describe an extreme El Nino event?
So like I said before, an extreme one is actually when the rainfall anomalies associated with the event move all of the way from so they're normally located in the western equatorial Pacific, and they move all of the way across to the eastern equatorial Pacific. So that's how they classify extreme ENSO events, but it's this rainfall response. So it's instead of putting heat up into the atmosphere, which drives the global circulation in the western equatorial Pacific, we're moving it a long way, like over 100 degrees in longitude to the east. This in itself will have dramatic changes for the global climate and weather patterns, obviously for a finite period, for you know a six-month period or 12-month period while the event's occurring.
Now, do we have statistical facts showing that extreme El Niños are more frequent? And secondly, how do we know greenhouse warming is a factor instead of some long-term cycle in the oceans?
So at present, so there has only been two of these extreme El Nino events in the observational record, and it's just not enough to show statistically significantly that what we're seeing now is due to climate change. In terms of the future projection, so this is talking about climate model ensembles, and we're talking about, you know, I think kind of 35 different models that have each been run for 100 years. And I think in terms of the natural variability within these models, you don't anticipate each of these different models to have the natural variability in the same phase, if do you understand what I mean? So if you picture something as an oscillation, if it's just naturally occurring with the climate system, it won't line up within each of these different models. So when you're looking at the ensemble, so the all of the models together, this internal variability will be cancelled out.
It makes sense to me because it's where the word asymmetry comes in, which is we're looking for something here that doesn't fit a pattern. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically. So each of the models has its own internal variability, but it's obviously different in all of the models. So when you're looking across all of them, it basically disappears. And then what you're seeing, because the only common thread amongst each of these models is that they have been forced by increasing greenhouse gases.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with climate researcher Shane McGregor at Australia's Climate Research Centre in Sydney. And I'd like to follow up. That letter in Nature Climate Change also suggested that El Niños in the future could have profound social and economic impacts. We've touched on that a little bit, but can we go into a bit more detail on the predicted impacts in different parts of the world, say starting with America, and what about Australia and Europe? Does it affect Europe and South America?
Okay, so in terms of starting with the U.S., I actually think the El Nino events have reasonably good impacts for the U.S. I think most of California is currently in drought at the moment, and El Nino events generally lead to more rainfall than normal along the U.S. West Coast. And it also it's been linked to kind of milder winters, so kind of, not as cold winters for the U.S. In terms of rainfall for South America, it leads to kind of large-scale floods along much of the west coast of South America, which can be quite devastating. If we go then move along to the southwest Pacific, so off the east coast of Australia, it has dramatic impacts on tropical cyclones and where the cyclones actually form. So reasonably good news for Australia, that the number of cyclones that enter the Australian region is dramatically less during El Nino events. But what happens is these events, where they form, shifts further to the east, okay, and it allows them to form in regions over and around Fiji, Samoa, Tonga. So these regions are much more likely to be impacted by tropical cyclones during El Nino events. Australia in general, El Nino events lead to much drier conditions and much hotter conditions. So it has been linked to drought, large-scale drought over much of the east coast of Australia.
That sounds interesting, and especially about Australia, because you just had a record hot year in 2013. It's hard to imagine it getting much hotter, but it sounds like it could.
Yeah, that's true. And also 2013, well, currently at present, I think 50% of New South Wales and 80% of Queensland is currently drought declared. So, and this is in the absence of any kind of major El Nino event. So if an El Nino event was to come along this year and cause it to be even drier, I can't imagine it would be a good scenario for the farmers in those regions.
And can this weather system reach as far as Europe, or is it dissipated and other things are playing there?
I think it plays a less of a role, but it's definitely been linked to, I think, like the ski season and kind of rainfall and storminess in those regions. It's also linked to increased dryness over the Indian subcontinent. It kind of really has global effects. I think it's also even been linked. I think maybe the statistics and the number of events that you is kind of limited, but it's also been linked to rainfall along the east coast of Africa. So it does have like kind of globally reaching effects.
Well, scientists are famous for their uncertainty, and we've heard some of it in this interview. What are some of the things we don't know about El Nino that we'd like to know?
So I suppose one of the main things that we don't know that we'd like to know is how El Nino has reacted in the past. So basically, we've got really, really good observations of the tropical Pacific from about the mid-1980s until present day. This is kind of changing a little bit now. Our observational network is kind of going down a little bit at the moment. So we've got a really good observational network for about 20 to 30 years there. Prior to that, we kind of have reasonably good observations. So we're talking about kind of ship tracks for about the 30 years before that. So from about 1950 to 1960, we've got an idea of what was happening in the tropical Pacific. But it turns out when we look in these climate models, you kind of really need 500 or 600 years to really understand how much natural variability ENSO has in terms of its magnitudes and occurrence rates. And so definitely one of the main things we don't know, or one of the main things we need, is more observation and better observations, basically.
Now, we've talked about the oceans. Does the ocean water actually get hotter? Does El Nino affect ocean life as well?
Oh, it definitely affects ocean life. It has huge implications for kind of coral reefs. and fisheries. So I think in terms of the U.S., I think in terms of California, so basically when an El Nino happens off the west coast of South America, the warm waters warm up, and this allows a lot more tropical fish to kind of move further northwards. Some of the negative impacts of this are that the salmon in the Pacific Northwest suffer because kind of Pacific mackerel kind of can push northward along the coast, and they tend to eat the young salmon and compete with the adult salmon for food. So it has dramatic impacts on the salmon population. But also, I think from what I understand, commercial fishermen, or like sports fishermen, actually enjoy it a lot more because they get to catch a lot more different fish than what they would normally catch due to these warm waters.
And it's really bad for coral as well, as I understand it, which is already threatened in many places in the world.
Yeah, that's true. So I think most of the eastern half of the equatorial Pacific can generally get much warmer than normal, and it can lead to bleaching events kind of in these regions. I think at present, it's kind of the global warming is kind of already kind of increasing sea surface temperatures in these regions as well, increasing the occurrence of bleaching events. And this is just another thing kind of to add on to, have an impact on coral reefs.
So at what point in this year of 2014 would you feel confident saying, yes, we will have an El Nino this winter or next spring? When do you expect one?
I do expect one. And I was at a conference recently talking with a lot of other people that kind of are researching ENSO, and I think a large proportion of the community expect one. And I think, like I said, the probability of one occurring is estimated around 70%. As in terms of when I would be confident to say there's definitely going to be El Nino, it's probably not going to be until around September. But in saying that, I think it was September in 2012, sea surface temperatures had breached kind of El Nino thresholds, and it was on the verge of being declared an event, and then it just pretty much dissipated straight away. So that was the first time that had happened in the kind of very limited observational record. So in the last kind of 30 or 40 years, that's the first time that had actually been observed to happen, like an event kind of really start and look like it was going to go and then stop. So I think come September, I think we'll have much more of an idea. So once we get through this, the Northern Hemisphere winter, or the American winter, we'll have much better ideas, and the models will also give us much better information in regards to the potential amplitude of the event.
Is there anything that I've missed that you think the public ought to know about this powerful weather machine?
I suppose one of the biggest things is we are, like, while we do have a pretty good understanding of how it operates, we're still learning about it, and we really need to keep up our observations of the tropical Pacific, and this includes many measures, so like satellite observations, and at the moment there's an array of buoys that are kind of moored in the tropical Pacific, and I think there's 70-plus buoys moored around the tropical Pacific at present. And the thing is, from about 1994, this array network has been fully functional and it's been operating about 90% capacity. But in the last 2 years, it's kind of been underserviced. And the amount of data that is returning from this network is about 40. So of those 70, roughly kind of 20 to 30 of them are actually sending information back to us at the moment. So it's looking like it's going to be a little bit precarious. I think we really need to keep investing in this observational network.
We've been talking with Dr. Shane McGregor. He's a research fellow at Australia's Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. You can find links to the science and news we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. You can also find this interview on Radio EcoShock's sound page after a few days, and you can pass it on to other people from there. Dr. McGregor, thank you so much for spending time with our listeners.
Okay, thanks a lot for having us, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Will El Nino finally be the weather disaster that jolts humans and their governments out of denial? There's plenty of fear, real and imagined, to go around. In the May 7th edition of New Scientist magazine, under the headline, "World is unprepared for major El Nino later this year," Michael Slezak writes, quote, "The weather is preparing to go wild and will wreak havoc and death around the globe later this year. An El Nino, a splurge of warm water in the Pacific Ocean, is coming. It will unleash floods in the Americas, while Southeast Asia and Australia face drought. Yet little is being done to address these consequences," end quote. He then goes on to quote Axel Timmerman from the University of Hawaii that the tropical system is ready to fling a big El Nino at us. The last large El Nino of 1997-98, he tells us,
killed 20,000 people and cost $97 billion in damage. Scientists and meteorologists, Slezak reports, are worried in private but don't want to cause a public panic. The same New Scientist magazine also carries an editorial warning that overly cautious scientists may be endangering the world. Quote, "The effects of the huge El Niño of the 1990s were all the worse because cautious forecasts didn't allow people to prepare. It shouldn't happen again. A major El Niño is massing in the Pacific Ocean and is likely to cause cyclones, tornadoes, droughts, floods, and sea level changes across the world. Many leading scientists say the approaching El Niño looks similar in magnitude to the huge one that started in 1997 and went on to kill tens of thousands of people and cause tens of billions of dollars in damage. But you won't hear that sort of warning from official forecasters. They agree that an El Niño is likely, but are saying little about its potential strength," end quote from New Scientist magazine. Also warning of bad things to come is Joe Rome, the former Clinton energy advisor and honored parent of the Climate Progress blog, one of the top sources for climate information on the planet. The headline of his article published May 8th is, "El Niño chances to jump to near 80%, add in global warming and we face record heat." Joe Rome writes, "If this El Niño does start fairly quickly and become quite strong, as many currently expect, then 2014 could well become the hottest year on record, and 2015 would likely break all previous global records," end quote. I think he's right, but we have to be careful about what we believe and what we can prove so far with science. I thought, and still believe, that starting out with a hotter world, this next El Niño, whenever it comes, can create startling changes in the world. Let me explain that and why I could be wrong. Common sense tells me that warming could make El Niño more powerful, more damaging. Why? Two reasons. First, the oceans are heating up as incremental heat is transferred to the seas. And remember, more of the sea is exposed to the sun as the Arctic loses sea ice for longer periods, but we'll call that a small effect for now. But overall, around the world, the oceans are soaking in more heat. El Niño, we know, is driven by hotter oceans. Second, we know more water vapor is being held in the atmosphere with warming. There is at least 4% more water up there, some say 7%, than there was in 1970. El Niño is partly about the transfer of rains from the western Pacific further east, possibly all the way to California and the west coast of South America. What would have been natural flooding may become supercharged extreme rainfall events with El Niño's help. While all that's probably true, I've checked with several scientists who are emphatic there is no science so far to show that climate change has made El Niño stronger. Our guest Shane McGregor, who is an expert in the field, says so. I also phoned Dr. Matthew England, the Deputy Director of the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. He's part of a team of scientists who recently published an important paper on El Niño. Dr. England said recent science shows El Niño events will likely become more common as the world warms. This global weather disturbance may come every 10 years instead of every 20 years. But there is no evidence that global warming has made El Niño more intense than it was, say, 1,000 or even 70,000 years ago. My impression is we have to separate the idea of El Niño, the giant oceanic swing state, from things like hurricanes and other storms. El Niño is not a storm. Matthew England said there is little doubt that hurricanes, known as tropical cyclones in the southern hemisphere, will become more violent as warming develops further over the next decades. Again, the science doesn't say there will necessarily be more hurricanes or typhoons, but when they do come, the extra sea heat and water vapor will likely give us things like Super Typhoon Haiyan, which raked part of the Philippines flat in November 2013, or nasty and expensive storms like Hurricane Sandy last year. El Niño is just the opposite. We have science saying there will be more El Niño events, but no proof they will be stronger. Still, I'm sticking to my common sense view, apparently echoed by Joe Rome, that if we begin a warming event from an already hot world, it will be worse. We'll have to wait and see as the global experiment with weather develops in the coming years. I started out by saying El Niño and the whole cycle of the Pacific called ENSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, is hard to grasp. That's because it's not a particular thing, but a complicated large-scale system of things. We humans have trouble with global cycles that only show up every decade or two. Our attention span is smaller and shorter than that. What we can understand easily is this. The more prevalent partner to El Niño is La Niña, the girl child in Spanish. La Niña, with its cooler mix of ocean waters, has operated like a massive air conditioner for the world. La Niña is one of the factors which masks the actual warming we are creating with our excess greenhouse gas emissions. With El Niño, we expect the air conditioner will be run in reverse, releasing some of the heat built up in the ocean. We may, as Joe Rome warns, experience the heat we are creating daily. It could be a record hot year globally in 2015 or even this year if El Niño shows up in full strength. It's like an audition for the future. That doesn't necessarily mean you won't be cold next winter. El Niño has been known for milder winters in the Northern Hemisphere. But there are other factors at work. Another huge change in the planetary weather system due to abnormal heating in the Arctic. The jet stream has been altered, scientists tell us, which may have brought the stalled polar vortex of cold air over most of North America last winter, even while the Arctic was much hotter than it usually is. The jet stream change has happened in the southern hemisphere as well, Matthew England told me. Winds that used to bring rain to Australia have moved further south toward the pole. They may never return in thousands of years. That is why the major city of Perth, Australia, had to spend $2 billion on a desalinization plant to get enough water to survive as a city. The same thing may be coming for California. We have no idea how the changed jet stream will interact with El Niño. That's what happens when we mess with the global scale climate systems. The weather becomes a crapshoot and the odds are against us. I know many of you are expecting, not hoping for, but expecting, some major sign of climate change that will finally push the public into demanding action. Will it be El Niño this year or next? I doubt it. There will be plenty of flashy weather porn reported in the news. Maybe 10 or 30,000 people will die. If they're not Americans or Europeans, we don't care much. Even when 30,000 Europeans died in the heat wave of 2003, nobody marched in the streets protesting inaction on fossil fuels. The El Niño of 1997-98 was a disaster for the atmosphere. It occurred at the same time when farmers and corporations in Indonesia were clearing and burning forests on a grand scale for palm oil plantations and simple logging. Giant areas of peat were exposed, dried, and burned. Suddenly, Indonesia, hardly a major industrial country, vaulted up to about third place among global carbon emitters. The peat fires buried Asia in smoke and pumped a giant burst of carbon into the atmosphere. All that carbon is still there. It pushes down the accelerator on warming, but the public hardly knows about it. Ask around. They don't know. El Niño will add to the background of worry. It will change some minds. But if you are counting on this boy child, literally the Christ child in Spanish, as a turning point to save the world, don't. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
With an ear for solutions, Radio EcoShock continues our long-running series on home permaculture and backyard gardening. Next, we visit Calgary, Canada, which just hit national news for their snowfall in May. Luke Kimmel is one of the leaf ninjas, fostering green jobs and local food there. Luke, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's a pleasure.
What are the leaf ninjas? Tell us about your project.
Sure. So the leaf ninjas, we're four entrepreneurs in our mid-20s. We're all born and raised in Calgary, and we're really passionate about giving back to this city through being involved in the local food movement. So specifically, we do edible landscaping, where we consult on and design, install, and maintain edible landscapes, largely focused on food forestry. And then we've operated our urban farm for the last 2 years, on borrowed land in some inner-city communities, where we then grow produce on that land and sell it to farmers markets and restaurants.
So, Luke, a key part of this story for me is the way young people can create their own jobs with alternative urban growing. How did you get started, and how did this morph into a successful business?
That's a great question. It's one I do speak more and more on these days, as we've actually, 4 years later, found some success in it. But it's a rocky road, and I would say that we took a really grassroots approach. This was not our first business, so this is actually my third or fourth business venture that I've been involved in, and so I did have some kind of entrepreneurial tact. I did prepare a couple of things. The main things that we did were get involved in our community. So as soon as I discovered kind of the value of land and wanting to get reconnected with food and things like that, I got involved with the local community and found some mentors. And I really did everything I could to earn their respect and get around them and spend time with them and glean some knowledge. So that entailed a whole summer of basically volunteering my weekends to attend these garden installations and learn as much as I could on the ground. You know, and then on top of that, just attending courses and workshops, and then I did some volunteer design for some friends, and then that went okay. And then I slowly started charging just small fees for doing design to the point now where we're basically up there with any other landscaping company in the city doing this professionally.
How many people do you employ?
We employ the four partners of Leaf Ninjas. So Leaf Ninjas is four partners, and then we have one full-time employee and a variety of subcontractors that we work with on a kind of project-to-project basis.
Can you make enough money spring to fall to stay alive during the long Canadian winter?
Yes, we figured that out. I think we're just getting there this year. For us, the landscaping and design approach really stood out as being something that wasn't being offered as a service in Calgary and something there was high demand for. So we just really paid attention to the different niches that were available in the market and identified that one and have gone with it. And I think for anybody doing this kind of work, if you can find ways to diversify, like for us, for example, we've begun a propagation program where a lot of the plants that we'd love to grow here, like Good King Henry and Giant Solomon Seal, very difficult to buy or impossible to buy as plant material. We have to grow it out from seed. So that's turned into an income stream for us. Another one is the speaking and teaching. So as soon as you've, you know, found some things out through being on the ground and getting that hands-on experience, then being able to pass that on and share that value with other people through teaching. So diversifying in the income stream is kind of key, just like it is to diversify in the garden.
Those are good tips. So, Luke, what is spin farming?
Spin farming, it stands for small plot intensive, and it's basically urban-focused practice for organic growing, where the whole model is based on farms that are an acre or an acre and a half in size max. Our urban farm was never bigger than half an acre. And I think the model really succeeds because it's based on you don't have to own land and you just own your own tools and equipment. And we borrowed land, and this is what spin farmers typically do. They borrow land in the city, whether it's open backyards or big front yards or entire empty lots. And then that land is given in exchange for a share in the produce. And really, we see the homeowners that have lent us land get a lot of value just simply out of helping out with this initiative and feeling like they, even though they're not in the garden growing the produce, they have a huge hand in supporting the urban agriculture movement, and that, you know, allows people to feel like they're doing something, and they really are.
Do spin farmers in Calgary work together, or is it all competitive?
Well, when we got going, there was one other spin farming company that was doing it professionally. So we were the second, and now there's nine companies that are urban farming this year in Calgary. So we're very blessed in that the scene here, you know, whether it's spin farming or permaculture, it's generally very cooperative. We have a strong market here in Calgary where people are willing to pay for a lot of these services. So there's kind of enough fish in the sea that we can have a collaborative approach. We've actually helped develop and mentor some of these farmers, the new farmers coming up this year and last year, and we've created an organization called the YYC Growers and Distributors, and this is a network of these urban spin farmers combined with some rural farmers, and together we're putting together a CSA, so the Community Supported Agriculture, and we've seen a lot of buy-in from people with that, and that's helped a lot of these new farmers, you know, not have to buy a rototiller, or not have to buy the walk-in cooler, and share their resources amongst each other, which has just been fantastic and so rewarding to see.
You know, I saw a photo of Geneva backyards, and there was not a lawn to be seen. It was fence-to-fence gardening and food growing, and apparently they cooperate and tell each other, well, I'll grow this and you grow that. What's your vision for backyard farming in North American cities?
Well, one thing that I really hope for is that this can become, well, and I see it, that it is becoming a respected thing. People think this is cool, it's new, and they get that we need to make some shifts in our overall culture, and they see this as being one positive way that we can do that that's very accessible. So I see this becoming more normal, and I do see people you know, of any walk of life, recognizing that quality food comes from locally grown sources. And there's a huge correlation there. So I think that as more people, you know, of all walks of life, the professionals that we do their gardens in downtown, they know that the tomato tastes better from the vine than it does from the store. And the young people who see that, wow, you know, there's some other young folks out there that have, you know, not had to follow the mold and go do the university thing or just work in a full-time career. They've been able to make something for themselves from working with the land, and that's cool. So I do see this becoming more normal and actually something that's sought after.
Luke, you just went through a punishing long winter. I know there are melts occasionally from the famous warm winds in Calgary called the Chinook, but even that break can be a problem for plants that are exposed to the next sub-zero cold snap. And I haven't mentioned the infamous hailstorms that has Calgary gardeners operating a Twitter alert service to cover up. And backyards, you need a pickaxe to dig the soil up the first time. How the heck can you grow food in Calgary?
Well, that's like many things. When we take the permaculture approach, we can turn a problem into a solution. And for us, people believe that you can't grow anything in Calgary. And that gives us shock value when all of a sudden we have a plant list of over, you know, 50 to 100 species that we use and work readily in this climate. I think the key things are basically site selection comes down to be a huge thing. Because you're right, it is a very, very harsh climate. And if we just go out into the middle of a prairie and try and start a garden where we're exposed to these harsh winds and we're not getting excess rainfall or irrigation, I mean, it's going to be difficult to grow much of anything in that kind of a site. But when we look at these urban environments, and particularly if we can find south-facing microclimates that are sheltered from sort of the north and west winds, then just through selecting the right site, we can, you know, jump ahead from that zone 2-3 growing condition to maybe even a 4-5. So there's a big sway just based on that. Some of the other things are just what species we're selecting. I mean, we're huge fans here of the sea buckthorn, the sea berry. Grows just about in any soil and very, very hardy. Produces that amazing berry. The green and red aurax, the mountain spinach, sunchoke. So choosing these really hardy species. And again, diversity. Like if some of our greens or our rhubarb or whatever gets destroyed by the hail, there's a higher chance that if we had trees growing over that and some shrubs, that force is going to be dissipated. And then, of course, things like greenhouses do make a ton of sense in this climate. And we get more and more into that as the years go on.
Yeah, the past winter was brutally cold for most of North America. Luke Kimmel, how can home gardeners protect their perennial plants and trees from the polar vortex?
One thing that we noticed massive success from this year was anywhere that the snow was piling. So even if you're putting up temporary snow fencing or using a crop like sunchoke or even sunflower and leaving those stalks up over the winter and you're getting some kind of snow catchment, we found that snow mulch, even if it was 4 to 6 inches, in areas where that mulch stuck around, our clovers and strawberries, the other ground covers, some of these herbaceous perennials are popping up out of the ground already. Whereas sites where there was no snow cover are bare and very dry and dead-looking. So if you can bury the plants in snow, or even a leaf mulch or any brought-in mulch, I think that's going to, especially in the early season, help you get a head start.
Another great tip. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with Luke Kimmel, part of the local business called the Leaf Ninjas in the Western Canadian city of Calgary. Some of the heavy work around there gets done with a perma-blitz. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm hugely passionate about the perma-blitz, or sometimes as we call them, garden blitzes. So basically there's three parties that come together to make a perma-blitz happen. You have the homeowner who supplies all the costs, provides food and beverages for the volunteers throughout the day. Then there's a designer who's been hired to create a design, a permaculture design for the site. And they are also, they're going to facilitate the volunteers and educate them, inform them about what to do, how to install that garden properly. And they're responsible for providing leadership and education. And then the volunteers show up, and really they get fed an amazing meal, beverages and snacks throughout the day, and then they get to have some hands-on experience in the garden, and as well as this guided leadership. And we definitely take breaks and do kind of workshop-style education with a whiteboard around specific things in the garden. So it's really a win-win-win all the way around. The homeowner saves a ton of money. It's one of the only very low, you know, low-commitment, low-risk opportunities for people to actually get hands-on experience in the garden without having their own garden. And it's great for us as well, as facilitators.
A couple of other projects I've heard about in Calgary. One is called The Verge. What is that?
So Verge Permaculture, ran by Rob and Michelle Avis, they've been huge mentors of ours. And, I mean, it comes back to how we got involved in the community. And I chased Rob around Western Canada, followed him to all of his speaking events and all his workshops, and eventually convinced him to let me work for him for a seven-month period. But these guys are amazing, and they're both ex-mechanical engineers who worked in the oil and gas industry in Calgary and have now transitioned into studying permaculture and teaching permaculture. And, I mean, their course and their mentorship, their leadership, like, there's no way we would be here if they hadn't been that pioneer species kind of readying the ground and making way for, really, they've made the way for a handful of probably over a dozen entrepreneurs through their courses and workshops who have been able to now run their own businesses.
What is their names again? I missed that.
It's Rob and Michelle Avis with Verge Permaculture.
You know, I got to be honest, Calgary's known as the oil capital of Canada. It's got lots of offices for tar sands corporations. It's a city of giant pickup trucks. But Calgarians just elected Canada's first Muslim mayor and has a surprisingly vibrant alternative community. How do those two go together?
It's the closet greenies. It's everybody who works and makes their living, you know, doing something for the industry or finance or IT or whatever it is. But then I think at the end of the day, people are still left with this question of, like, how do we fit in this planet? And they recognize that the messaging is just keeps coming up, that there needs to be a shift, there needs to be a shift. And so I see that a lot of these folks still working in these industries want to do something in their spare time, like have a garden. Personally, I'm very passionate about connecting with that exact niche and helping them do that. Because I think it's one of those small steps.
An important one. So you get your local city farm produce. How do you get it to consumers, especially if some people are sold on big supermarkets or Walmart? How do you get what you grow out there?
Holy. Well, that's one of the biggest challenges that I think the urban farmers face, is that for people to engage and get this produce, it often requires a bit of a shift from their usual shopping habit. What do I say about that? I mean, the CSA is really a great model for that, because it's a weekly pickup where, well, basically, for anyone that doesn't know, it's a community-supported agriculture where people put up money at the front of at the beginning of the year and buy basically a share in the farm, and then they get a delivery for anywhere from, in Calgary, 17 to 20 weeks usually, max, sometimes 25 for the really good farmers. That's probably one of the best ways. And then the other thing is that we have some community organizations, community associations that have really established and very successful farmers markets, namely Hillhurst Sunnyside has done an amazing job. Their market is very well attended, and we found for us that when we attended that market, sold our produce, that it was one of the most well-received, and we did the best financially there.
So for listeners who are warming up to the idea of a permaculture yard, what would it look like?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I mean, I'm answering this question kind of day in, day out, and the first thing that I always stop people on and say is, you know what, we've really got to examine our goals. Because we deal with a wide set of goals. I mean, some people are really concerned about the aesthetics, and that's the primary thing. But they come to us because they want the meaning of having a sustainable food-producing garden. So the plant choices for them is going to be very different than someone who says, I want to be producing as much of my own food as possible. You know, some people want to relax in their garden. Some people want exercise. Some people want privacy, and other people want to educate and bring in the community. So I'd say, first of all, it really depends. It really depends on the goals. But in general, what our gardens end up looking like is we incorporate rainwater harvesting, so all the water off of the roof or a driveway is diverted into the landscape through a series of either terraces or basins, swales, dry creek beds. And that kind of forms the backbone for the garden, especially with the dry creek bed. It has that beautiful, natural, yet landscaped aesthetic. And then other than that, we're working with basically a forest-like system. It looks like a young savanna, a young woodland ecosystem. So we've got the fruit trees generally along the north sides kind of the house that cascade down into hedgerows of shrubs that may be placed for privacy, and then the herbaceous layers of the horseradish, comfrey, hostas, rhubarb. And as much as we can, we actually work with common landscaping plants such as the ostrich fern and the hosta. People's eyes are already trained to recognize these plants as beautiful landscaping plants, and, you know, little do they know they were also edible. So it can be very beautiful, but it also really does shift based on the individual goals of the homeowner or the client.
Wait a minute. Can you eat a hosta?
You can, yeah. You can eat the young shoot of the hosta. So it's you would eat it in the same way that you would eat asparagus or the Solomon's seal, where you pick the young shoot and then you let it grow out and become that beautiful plant later on in the year.
Almost like the ferns we used to pick in Ontario. You had to get them when they first came up and then maybe fry them in butter or something. But if you left them any later than that, they were not so good for you.
Yeah, exactly. So we do work with those ferns as well, the ostrich fern.
When you talk to new customers, why do you think more people are ready to transition from the lawn culture to this home permaculture?
I see that people come to this through many avenues, and I mean, health and wellness is one, where a lot of the narratives around health and wellness right now point towards quality food, and you know, people are recognizing that quality food inherently is food locally grown a lot of times, grown organically. So there's the health and wellness aspect, there's the climate change piece where people are concerned and they want to do something, and having a home garden is just one step to help ease the weight that we put onto the industrial food system. And spiritual reasons as well, social reasons where people want to have, you know, a space that they can invite their friends and family into and have a feeling of sanctuary. So for us, we get everywhere from the kind of anarchist approach all the way to the other side of the spectrum, which is, I work full-time and I'm busy, I just want to have a nice garden. But I find it very interesting how we deal with such a wide spectrum of people, and the garden is that common ground that we're finding.
You've created a longing in me. I'll put some links to the ideas and organizations we've talked about in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. That's published every Wednesday. Luke, please tell our listeners where they can find the Leaf Ninjas online.
All right. We're at www.leafninjas.ca, and we're also very active on our social media on Facebook, facebook.com/CalgaryLeafNinjas, and our Instagram as well, instagram.com/LeafNinjas. Those are probably some of the best places to keep updated with our work.
And now I'm going to show my age. What really is Instagram for?
It's one of the fastest working social media, where people are often just taking pictures and posting them from mobile devices. So we'll do that, where we'll post a picture of a piece of work we've just done, or some food we've just harvested or something like that. And there's a lot of really great gardeners and permaculturists that are using that tool, and it just does help to make it a little bit cooler to do this kind of stuff and to show that value in a really easy way.
Well, I could see it could be handy. I mean, you've got a leaf of a plant, you're wondering, what's this? Or maybe even an insect. Has anybody seen this? You could just share it that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've been talking about local food ideas that work with Luke Kimmel of the Leaf Ninjas in Calgary, Canada. Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure, Alex. Thank you for all your work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. On Radio EcoShock, we broadcast through many college stations as part of my outreach to the younger generation who will live through climate change. I'm going to announce a competition to write modern music about climate change. You can get in early with details in this week's show blog at ecoshock.info. There's a free download of climate quotes any podcaster, broadcaster, or songwriter can use. ecoshock.info for the details. Meanwhile, here's a short tune I wrote last week while toiling away at this program. It's called Heal Me. You can listen again or download my music and this program all on the Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page. It's catching on fast. Check it out. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to talk to Eve Engler, author and lecturer. He's written a couple of really tremendous books. Right off the top, I can mention Canada in Africa and The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. And terrific books. He really is a classic muckraking author. And later in the show, we will talk to Stephen Gowans, who has written books, very timely ones, about Syria and the struggle on the Korean Peninsula for the sovereignty of the Korean people, actually. But today, Stephen's going to be talking about his most recent article, which deals with the damage done by sanctions, illegal sanctions, in which Canada participates zealously, happily. And Stephen has written an essay in his column, What's Left, and telling what we need to know about that. So we'll talk to Stephen Gowans. We'll also probably have a little music from a gentleman called Lord Invader, and we'll talk about that as well. It's kind of an important. We're talking about, you know, themes of anti-colonialism. It's a still living issue. I think we are joined by Eve Engler. You there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Very good. Eve, it's a pretty dramatic development. On the 20th of this month, a statement was issued by a number of writers and politicians and labor leaders, and you among them, and saying that directly you're asking or that the New Democratic Party correct its mistake of at this time building a friendship with Israeli parliamentarians when we have these terrible events, but particularly the Gaza March of Return, which was a nonviolent episode, as far as I know, in which the Israeli army used live ammunition and a number of people died. Tell us why the urgency of this step of the public statement by the, I think, is at least 200 people.
Yeah, basically, it's a open letter endorsed by many NDP activists, people like Roger Waters, the founder of Pink Floyd, Noam Chomsky, Linda McQuaig, Mike Pelichek from the Canadian Union Postal Workers, and more than 200 people who basically calling on NDP to withdraw from the Canada-Israel Interparliamentary Group. The NDP has two main people on that interparliamentary group, Murray Rankin and Randall Garrison, mm-hmm. who are both Victoria MPs, and that the group basically is designed to build relations with Israel's parliament, and effectively what it is a pro-Israel lobby organization, and it's one of the avenues of anti-Palestinian activism into the NDP. It's not the only one. There are, the trips that the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs brings MPs on to Israel. There are Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs breakfasts at NDP conventions. There's still labor ministers from the Israeli Labor Party that come to the NDP conventions and whatnot. But this is a the Canada-Israel Interparliamentary Group, and the fact that there are four MPs that have lent their name to this organization is a very symbolic example of the ongoing ties between the NDP and Israel. And in the context of more than now we're at over 124 Palestinians killed in Gaza over the past 2 months. No one killed on the Israeli side. This is just, clearly killing of nonviolent protesters that aren't any sort of threat to Israel. The point of the letter is this is enough's enough. The NDP should long ago been moving towards challenging Canada's complicity towards Palestinian dispossession. But enough's enough. And there's it was amazed at the support for this open letter. There's people like Robert Laxer, who's been an NDP member since I think 1963, 15 years before I was born, who signed it. A lot of people who are not necessarily identified with pro-Palestinian activism endorsed the letter, and I think it's because people are starting to realize that, at what point is this going to end in terms of Canada's over-the-top support?
I noticed Judy Reaver signed it, Sid Ryan. I was very glad to see the name David Heap because, of course, he at this moment is organizing the Freedom Flotilla, one of the organizers. We spoke to him last week, but his father fought very hard on this issue. And he was elected member of parliament, quite popular. There's always been this this element there, but NDP went through a period of years where they decided to strategically silence anybody in the party. Right? I wonder what's your thoughts about it. Jagmeet Singh did make some critical comments on the when Gazans were killed. Do you notice is there some perception that maybe they're developing eyes and ears to beyond what they had?
There is no doubt that in the past handful of months, particularly since the Jerusalem embassy move by Trump, that the NDP has begun to put out quite a number of decent statements criticizing Canada's refusal to criticize Washington's move around the embassy, criticizing Trudeau's refusal to condemn the killings in Gaza. So there have been statements that have been a very positive shift vis-a-vis the Thomas Mulcair time. I believe that at the personal level, Jagmeet Singh is definitely much more sympathetic to Palestinians than Tom Mulcair, who of course once said, I support Israel in all situations and all circumstances. And then Lavadier, the foreign affairs critic, she has this whole background. In 2016, she went to speak at the APEC conference in Washington. She went to a Jewish National Fund event when she was in Israel. She has this background of doing these pro-Zionist kind of positions, but she has begun to take up Palestinian rights. And there's a whole series of factors I think that are explaining this. Partly change in leadership, partly the fact that the party membership have moved way far into sympathy for Palestinians over the past handful of years.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's in play. There is an internal battle going on within the NDP caucus on this issue, and that's part of the point. This letter. Yes, we want them to withdraw from the Canada Israel Interparliamentary Group, but this is as much part of a broader saying, okay, you've got to break these different connections with the pro-Israel lobby organizations and begin to really start challenging Canadian complicity. Because even the statements, the statements that have been coming out from Evan Lavadier, the foreign critic, and Jagmeet Singh, on the surface, they are pretty decent statements, but we're not hearing anything about the fact that there's hundreds of millions of dollars in tax subsidized money going to Israel through different charities. Some of those charities supporting explicitly racist organizations like the Jewish National Fund. Some of those charities supporting settlement projects in West Bank. Some of those charities supporting the Israeli military. There's no discussion coming from the NDP on something like that. There's no discussion coming from the NDP on the fact that most of the aid that we're actually giving to Palestinians is designed explicitly to support security forces, Palestinian Authority security forces that are putting down protests against Abbas's sellout to Israeli expansionism. There's little about many different elements of Canadian complicity in Palestinian dispossession. So again, the statements are positive. But there's much broader work that needs to be done with.
One thing that occurred to me reading the statement, and it is an impressive list of names, and I'm sure that it's appearing on many sites. People should find this. And we're speaking to Eve Engler, one of the signatories, and author of Canada in Africa and the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. Now we're having this sort of the Trump twist to American policy. And I noticed that the reporting is that Trump and Mr. Kushner, his personal emissary, are thinking of a plan which would basically exclude the Palestinians, where they say, well, we're inviting you, but if you don't come, that's your tough luck. And I wonder if this is time also for the NDP and Liberal Party and everybody else to reinforce the existence of Palestinian political representation. I guess there are some initiatives, but you would think that, as well as saying, why are you developing friendship with a government that has used live ammunition against civilians, how about also strengthening the ties with political representation of the Palestinians?
Yeah, well, that's the political representation of the Palestinians gets into very tricky territory in terms of, what is the Palestinian Authority? What political representation are we talking about? The leadership of,
yes,
you know, what effectively the Bantustan?
Yes.
And or are we talking about, grassroots movements that are calling for boycott, divestment, sanctions? One of the things that was very interesting that came out of the a big delegation, it was 18 MPs, Canadian MPs, I think 6-7 of them were NDP MPs, that went on a recent delegation to Palestine. This is a big event. I think first time ever such a large number of MPs have gone.
Yes.
Sponsored by a group in Ottawa that's tied in with the Palestinian Authority. Well, both Alexandre Bourlis, the NDP MP here in Montreal, and I saw online Elizabeth May, who both went on the delegation, they both said that the Palestinians they talked to were opposed to boycott, divestment, sanctions. Mm-hmm. Well, the Palestinian Authority, of course, is opposed to the BDS movement. Mm-hmm. The Palestinian Authority also gets most of its money from Washington, yes, Ottawa, London, and we have the internal Canadian government documents saying very clearly that when the Harper government in 2012 was talking about withdrawing Canadian support for the Palestinian Authority, that the Israelis were pressuring Canada to continue supporting the Palestinian Security Force. Canada, the U.S., and Britain are training Palestinian Security Force, which basically acts as an Israeli tool of control of the West Bank. Yeah. And so when you get into these questions of how colonized or how,
right,
fragmented Palestinians are in Palestinian political factions, and how Canada. So if it is going to be there's a Canada Palestine Parliamentary Friendship Group, which a number of NDP MPs are part of, and the way that Jagmeet Singh responded to the open letter was to say, we're also part of this Canada-Palestine Parliamentary Friendship Group, and so we can be part of the Israel one, mm-hmm, and the Palestinian one, and we neutral, and we hear both sides and whatnot. Well, the reality is that most Palestinian political factions are identified as terrorist organizations, Canada, mm-hmm, right? The Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, I think there's 6 or 7 Hamas, 4 or 5 other Palestinian groups. So a delegation of Canadian MPs wouldn't even be allowed to go talk to important segments of Palestinian political life because they're banned as terrorist organizations in this country. Of course, you can talk to any side. You can talk to the most extreme Israeli settlers. You can talk to the Israeli military. You can talk to anybody on that side, because none of the Israeli side is defined as a banned organization in this country. So the idea, there is some tricky terrain when you get into this question of just,
yeah,
oh, well, let's support Palestinian political factions. Who are we talking about? We're talking about the grassroots movement that, you know, a few hundred Palestinian social movement organizations that have been calling for the BDS for the past 10 years, or are we talking about Palestinian Authority, which is basically bowing down in the face of Israeli expansion?
Yeah. But other angles too. I was struck by, and you know how the media has a very efficient technique of simply giving us a couple of days of sort of nebulous coverage where you can't quite identify what's happened. And then they sort of close their eyes and cross their fingers and hope you'll stop asking. But I do remember the prime minister said that there should be an independent investigation, but I haven't heard anybody say to him, so what's happened? And why couldn't these we ask these parliamentarians, go do your own investigation? That's what you're elected for, right?
No, for sure. I mean, the Israelis have said no to the independent investigation. The UN Human Rights Council there was a resolution. So Trudeau, on one hand, said, we want an independent investigation. And then when there was a UN resolution that came forward on it that was backed by almost every country in the world, Trudeau abstained on the question, didn't vote against because that would just be too embarrassing, but abstained. And that gets into the question of when there's some media attention. Let's be honest about it. It wasn't because Palestinians were killed. It was because it was a Canadian doctor that was shot, providing medical care for the dozens of others who were, been shot or be killed, and thousands now that have been seriously hurt. The reason the media covered it to the extent they did was because of the Canadian doctor. And so Trudeau felt like he had to make at least a small gesture.
And then once again laid low, exactly. Hoping everybody forget about it.
Yeah, exactly, and then that's part of the point of this open letter and the endorsement. People can sign the petition on change.org to call for NDP is to keep the pressure up, right? There's these little blips where it gets in the media, but then it's forgotten about. But we need to keep the pressure up, not just on the Trudeau government, but on the NDP as well to start really standing in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. And because our government is complicit in so many different ways in Palestinian dispossession, and that's not just this current government, that's not just the Harper government before, that goes back 70 years,
or
even before that, there are so many ways in which we can provide real concrete solidarity. And just by calling on our government to stop doing things, not some big complicated thing, just stop doing certain things you're doing that are contributing. That's the importance of this sort of initiative.
Definitely a single step would resonate big in this country. Yeah, so, Eve, it's a great project. I'm glad to see your name on it and all those other wonderful people. I urge people to read the statement and to actually contact and support all those who put their name to it. Thank you very, very much, Eve.
Thanks for having me on, and thanks for bringing up this topic.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Eve Engler, and he's the author of Canada in Africa. The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, which takes some Canadian policy all the way through, particularly as a neocolonial force. He's a great journalist and lecturer, and I should have asked him when he's going to come to Toronto next, because he makes the rounds and people are always glad to see him.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Pooja Gehi, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild, who assesses President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, the rightward direction of the court, and its future impact on the nation. Scott Edwards of Food and Water Watch, who discusses the resignation of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt and the future of the agency under his replacement, a former coal lobbyist. And Connecticut Legal Services attorney Joanne Lewis and Connecticut U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, who talk about a lawsuit that targets the psychological harm caused by the Trump administration policy of separating immigrant children from their parents. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Facing a rising tide of anti-immigrant resentment in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, a supporter of open borders within the European Union, caved in to hardline demands from Interior Minister Horst Seehofer to create border internment camps for asylum seekers. The surrender to Seehofer, leader of Merkel's longtime coalition partner, the Christian Social Union, threatened to topple the German coalition government, which also includes the center-left Social Democrats. Seehofer said he'd resign as interior minister if Merkel, a central figure in EU's immigration policy, did not accept new immigrant measures. The conservative Christian Social Union Party is the governing party in the state of Bavaria and feels threatened by the rise of the anti-EU, anti-immigrant far-right party Alternative for Germany. Seehofer and the CSU proposed the new hardline policies targeting asylum seekers in advance of Bavaria's state election this October. Since Merkel and her coalition government agreed to new border regulations, Seehofer has met with leaders of anti-immigrant governments in Austria and Italy in order to design a program to shut down the flow of immigrants from southern Europe, the entry point for thousands of people fleeing war and violence in North Africa and the Middle East. President Donald Trump recently returned to Wisconsin for the groundbreaking of the much-heralded Foxconn manufacturing complex that will make flat-panel display screens. Trump joined Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker and GOP House Speaker Paul Ryan in promoting the massive plant near Milwaukee, underwritten by nearly $5 billion in state financing. This is just the latest example of huge tax giveaways to high-tech firms promising to create jobs. The Guardian newspaper reports that Taiwanese-based Foxconn promised to create 3,000 jobs, far short of the 13,000 jobs boasted by Governor Walker. However, even if 13,000 new jobs are created, Wisconsin would be paying $346,153 per job for a total subsidy of $4.5 billion. An astronomical sum, but nothing compared to the $1.5 million for each job if the deal ends up creating just 3,000 new positions. In addition to skepticism about the trade-off of taxpayer dollars for the grandiose pledge of massive job creation, green activists are angry that the new Foxconn complex has been permitted to use 7 million gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan, an unprecedented betrayal of the Great Lakes Compact adopted in 2008 to preserve Great Lakes water resources. On March 18th, one of Uber's driverless cars, a Volvo SUV, hit and killed a homeless woman, Elaine Hertzberg, while she was trying to cross a street in Tempe, Arizona. The crash put a halt to Uber's plans to develop a driverless fleet this year in Arizona. Uber is just one of a dozen companies testing the use of autonomous vehicles, or AV, to establish a driverless service. According to In These Times magazine, the emergence of driverless cars could totally transform transit options for generations. The National Transportation Safety Board's initial report found that the self-driving system detected Hertzberg 6 seconds before the collision and called for an emergency brake 1.3 seconds before impact. But anonymous sources with Uber told the tech news site The Information that Uber had programmed the cars to avoid braking since frequent stops and starts can make passengers uncomfortable. The NTSB has not issued a final report or determined which party was at fault. While there are potentially many benefits that could grow out of the development of driverless vehicles, such as increased traffic safety, there is a dark side, too. For instance, the new automation technology could lead to the loss of nearly 4 million jobs for truckers who earn middle-class wages, and could also promote more suburban sprawl made possible with easier commuting options. Public policy is another area that could suffer. This spring, the billionaire Koch brothers group, Americans for Prosperity, helped defeat a $5.4 billion mass transit initiative in Nashville, in part by suggesting that driverless cars would make future government investment in public transit obsolete. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I am Richard Hill.
In a nationally televised announcement on July 9th, President Trump nominated Federal Appeals Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh to fill the vacancy left by the retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh is a former aide to President George W. Bush and had served as an investigator for independent counsel Kenneth Starr during the inquiry into President Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky that eventually resulted in Clinton's impeachment. Judge Kavanaugh's long history of conservative pro-corporate legal opinions will allow Senate Democrats to cite the nominees' more controversial positions in coming Senate confirmation hearings that they'll need if they hope to defeat his nomination. If he's confirmed, Kavanaugh will likely move the high court further to the right on laws relating to access to abortion and marriage equality, but also on other important issues, including civil rights, voting rights, labor law, immigration, health care, guns, and the environment. Some fear that in selecting Kavanaugh, President Trump was buying an insurance policy against possible future prosecution growing out of the Mueller probe into Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Kavanaugh wrote in a 2009 article for the Minnesota Law Review that Congress should pass a law exempting a president while in office from criminal prosecution and investigation, including from questioning by criminal prosecutors or defense counsel. Your reporter spoke with Pooja Gehi, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, who assesses Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, the rightward direction of the court, and its future impact on the nation.
Kavanaugh, from what I know of him, is he went to Yale. He's pretty conservative. He hasn't outright said that he wants to overturn abortion, but he's ruled quite a few times in support of the government creating barriers to access to abortion. He's not good on voter rights. He's not good on LGBT issues. He's pretty consistently originalist or constructionalist, which is really, I think, shorthand for interpreting the original intent that the framers had when they created the Constitution, right? Which, as we know from history, is really breaks down around upholding white supremacy and capitalism, in particular property interests, with a specific lens towards prioritizing corporate interest over personhood.
Tell us about how important this moment is when Donald Trump and the Republican Party will be pushing to confirm a new Supreme Court justice for a lifetime appointment. What's at stake in your mind in terms of this pivotal seat on the court?
Well, we all know Justice Kennedy was the swing vote for the past many, many, many years, and we're going to see very important social justice cases coming to the Supreme Court. We've already seen a ton of cases that have been ruled really badly around immigration, the unions, voting rights, et cetera. And I think, you know, we as the National Lawyers Guild know that the judicial system is not actually a tool that's going to create meaningful social change that we want to see in the world, but we also know that this nominee has the potential and likelihood of creating a really, really intensely harmful law that's going to impact people, and of course people who are going to be most impacted are people who are most vulnerable, poor people, people of color, immigrants, people in prison, and so on.
And I did want to ask you, when it comes to Roe versus Wade and the idea of Supreme Court precedent and justices who might be confirmed to the court overturning that precedent, how difficult a task is that for the court to turn that around, given it's been standard law here in the United States for so long?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I don't think it's going to happen overnight for sure. And I think it's interesting in listening to the interviews, because all of the nominees say, you know, they will enforce precedent. They want to enforce precedent. They're continuing enforcing precedent. And we know that that is, of course, not necessarily true, because it falls on ideological lines, but also access to abortion has been slowly being chipped away for quite a long time, for like the last decade plus, both in on the federal level, but certainly on the state level. And so I think that we're going to see more and more barriers to abortion before and if it gets overturned. But I do think it's definitely an urgent risk right now. And you know, like Trump ran on the platform saying that he was going to overturn Roe v. Wade, but I do think the actual process of hearing all of the case law and litigating it is going to at least take some time.
Conservative justices on the Supreme Court seem to be working towards undoing or unraveling key elements of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, as well as major civil rights legislation through the years, and most recently, the Voting Rights Act, where they've succeeded in gutting that particular provision passed by Congress. Tell us about your concerns about the attacks on the New Deal and civil rights here.
mean, I think that's absolutely true. The conservative core, along with Donald Trump, seems to be primarily concerned with prioritizing corporations over people, right, over the interests of people, and then also rolling back regulations that have been put in place to support government checks for a really long time. And I think this is where the parallel with libertarianism comes into place. It's like a move against government involvement and towards libertarianism, which people are interpreting as religious liberty, gun rights, freedom of speech, which has been interestingly used in a way that we on the left have not used freedom of speech in the past, right? So, but I think it's very, very strategically undoing the New Deal for sure.
And given those programs are so popular, what's the likely response from a country that is used to Social Security and Medicare, and more recently, used to insurance companies not being able to deny people coverage for pre-existing medical conditions? That's certainly going to affect a large swath of people, including Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, everybody.
Mm-hmm. I would say now is the moment that we need to be in the streets, doing civil disobedience, but also really stockpiling resources, being able to, if we can, stockpile contraception, stockpile hormones for trans people, stockpile all these things that we don't know that we're going to have access to in a short amount of time.
That was Pooja Gehi, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild. Find more analysis and commentary on President Trump's nomination of Brett Kavanaugh by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Trump's Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt was forced to resign on July 5th after multiple ethical scandals provoked opposition to his tenure, even from some congressional Republicans. When Pruitt took over at the EPA, he was well known for his climate change denier views and close ties to the fossil fuel industry when he earlier served as Oklahoma Attorney General. During his time at the EPA, Pruitt has been busy revoking or weakening critical environmental, health, and climate regulations, which has provoked many lawsuits and political opposition. Among his initiatives was reversing a proposal to ban a dangerous neurotoxic pesticide, chlorpyrifos, removing pollution regulations from industry, and repealing automobile efficiency standards that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Your reporter spoke with Food and Water Watch Climate and Energy Program co-director Scott Edwards, who discusses the resignation of Scott Pruitt and the future of the EPA under his replacement. Former coal industry lobbyist Andrew Wheeler, who's likely to continue the Trump regime's aggressive agenda to dismantle the agency.
Scott Pruitt came in, of course, to implement Trump's agenda, which was to dismantle the EPA, dismantle regulatory protections on the environment. The only thing I can say about Scott Pruitt is he was such a bumbling person and so incompetent. I mean, he's done a tremendous amount of damage, but many of the things that he tried to do to dismantle environmental protection, he did it in a really reckless, haphazard way, and thankfully the courts have stopped some of it, and it might be temporary, but he certainly has made his mark in the time he's been head of EPA. He's begun a lot of processes and completed some that are going to have devastating impacts unless we turn it around very, very quickly.
So there's a lot of concern now with the acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler, who's taken over on what could be a temporary or permanent basis. We're not sure yet. But he's a former coal lobbyist. Tell us a little bit about Andrew Wheeler's history and insider status in Washington.
Right. Well, he's got some things in common with Pruitt, and that is that, as you indicate, that he has a lot of strong ties to industry. In the case of Pruitt, he had strong ties not only to oil and gas industry, but to industrial ag operators, particularly companies like Tyson Food and other big corporations. Wheeler has strong ties to coal industry, and Massey Coal in particular, was a coal lobbyist. So they share those ties to corporate polluters, to entities, polluting entities that are supposed to be regulated by the EPA. Where they differ, and this is what makes Wheeler in many senses much more dangerous than Pruitt. And as I said, Pruitt sort of bumbled his way through a lot of these things and ended up out. He should have been out long ago, but ended up out of the job. Wheeler has played inside Washington. He does understand Washington. He was a staffer for Inhofe, a senator, a Republican senator, who might be the worst senator on the environment, certainly the worst sitting senator on the environment, perhaps the worst senator on the environment in many, many decades. So Wheeler is much more astute, much smarter than Pruitt, and he understands how Washington works, how Congress works. He will not be caught playing and blasting his sirens on the way to lunch. He will not be buying used mattresses from the Trump Hotel. He won't be doing any of those foolhardy, ridiculous things that Pruitt did. He's going to be quiet, he's going to be smart, and he's going to implement the same policies that Pruitt has started to implement and has tried to implement.
Have groups like yours, Food and Water Watch, and many other environmental groups across the country, have they come up with an effective strategy to push back on the Trump administration's aggressive effort to dismantle the EPA and protect polluters?
Ultimately, what we're going to have to do to survive this administration and this EPA is to change what Congress looks like. We still have a separation of powers in this country that doesn't exist right now because we have a one-party government in place at all levels, and now we're losing the Supreme Court. But this makes the November election so much more critical because Congress can control EPA. If Wheeler enacts or passes or proposes bad regulations, a affirmative, aggressive, progressive Congress can step up and enact laws that override the regulations that EPA tries to put in place. So we take them to court, and we have to fight to build political power to make sure there's some real oversight over EPA and that Congress is in power to stop Andrew Wheeler from doing what he wants to do, which is enact Trump's extremely devastating policies.
That was Food and Water Watch Climate and Energy Program co-director Scott Edwards. Find more commentary on Scott Pruitt's resignation and the future of the EPA by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Attorneys for two immigrant children kidnapped by U.S. government agents from their parents on the U.S.-Mexico border and then brought to Connecticut appeared in federal court in Bridgeport, Connecticut on July 11th. The lawyers are seeking a judge's ruling that the children, a 9-year-old boy from Honduras and a 14-year-old girl from El Salvador, be immediately released from a group home detention facility in eastern Connecticut and reunited with their parents. These children are just two of an unknown number of minors who were separated from their parents when they crossed a border seeking asylum. Trump administration officials initially said the separated children numbered about 2,000, but then indicated that the actual number was closer to 3,000. A federal judge in California gave the government 2 weeks to reunite children under 5 with their parents and a month to reunite all other children. But that first deadline passed, with only 54 of 102 so-called tender-age children returned to their parents. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended a press conference on July 6th at the Yale University Law School in New Haven, Connecticut, where attorneys and top state officials spoke about these cases involving immigrant children and the Trump administration's zero-tolerance crackdown on immigrants fleeing violence in Mexico and Central America. Joanne Lewis, an attorney from Connecticut Legal Services, began by describing the children's situation.
We met a 14-year-old girl
known in the litigation as VFB, who came with her mother. Now, having been abandoned by her father at birth, she was raised by her mother and stepfather. And her mother and she left El Salvador right after her stepfather was murdered outside the church where she and her mother were praying. When they got here, they were originally kept together for a short time in what the children call an hilera, or an icebox. And then one day, V was taken to go for a shower. And when she came back, her mother was gone. She was then brought up to Connecticut, and for more than a month, she had absolutely no contact with her mother. The shelter was looking for the mother. The Office of Refugee Resettlement was looking for the mother, and our attorneys were looking for the mother. And when we contacted ICE, the liaison with the shelter didn't even know she had come with a mother. Finally, we located the mother, and they had one phone call after more than a month. The other child, a 9-year-old, arrived a month later. He had been living with his father, who he describes as his hero. He has suffered more and experienced more than any adult, let alone 9-year-old, should ever have to experience. He has had his grandparents murdered, and more recently, his father's friend was murdered with a machete and the body dumped in his father's backyard so he could see it. As a warning or as an attempt to frame his father for the murder, we don't know, because we've had no contact with the father. But following that, the father took his son and came to Texas. They were also in an hilera for a few days, and then while the boy was sleeping, his father disappeared, and he was told all different stories about what happened and what would happen. In fact, he said to our attorney recently when she was talking to him, "I don't know what to believe anymore because people have lied to me so much." We asked some experts from the Yale Child Study Center to go out and interview these children. And based on their findings, we felt that it was urgent that we take further action. And I just want to give you a sense of what they said. The team that went out there was led by Dr. Andres Martin, who is a professor of child psychiatry at the Yale Child Study Center and the medical director of children and inpatient services at Yale New Haven Children's Hospital. Dr. Martin says, and this is in the declaration we filed with the court, "The enforced, prolonged, and painful separation from the primary caregiver creates a real and substantial risk of long-term and irreversible psychological, developmental, and psychiatric damage." That is why his recommendation was that the parent and children be reunified in a non-stressful setting. That means not in detention someplace in the country waiting for their asylum cases, but released and with family here in the United States.
I asked the following question at the press conference. Since the Trump administration has stated it will no longer consider victims of domestic violence or gang violence eligible for political asylum, will that make it more likely that once these families are reunited, they will just be deported together rather than be released in the U.S. to await an asylum hearing? Senator Richard Blumenthal responded this way.
First, there are plans to challenge that change in criteria because there is no legal basis to disregard or dismiss domestic violence, gang violence, other kinds of violence that have the implicit sanction of the government, especially where there's corruption in many of these Central American countries. They have become now the conduits for drugs coming to this country, and drug trafficking has become a major, in effect, government-supported industry there. But that legal challenge will go forward, and eventually it will go to the United States Supreme Court. So let's talk about the elephant in the room, right? The nominee is likely to be the crucial, decisive swing vote on testing the legality of all of the Trump administration immigration policies. These policies are, in many respects, illegal. We're talking here about the rule of law that will be determined for decades to come by the next nominee to the United States Supreme Court. And I can pledge to you, as a United States Senator, I will fight any nominee who fails to stand strong for due process and equal protection of the law when it comes to our immigration policy.
That was Connecticut Legal Services Attorney Joanne Lewis and Connecticut Senior U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal. Law students and professors from the Worker and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School are also representing the two children in the lawsuit. Find more views on the Trump administration's immigration policy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on RECFM in Riverton, Maryland, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Paradox of Liberty. Lest we forget, this chapter is about the great white Aryan Anglo-Saxon civilization's commitment to follow the sun, civilize the world, and help all the unfortunate savages find Jesus. One of those civilizing Anglos was, of course, Thomas Jefferson. In fact, the Smithsonian installed an exhibit dedicated to the greatest gentleman slave owner of the United States, entitled Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, Paradox of Liberty. Author Leah Caldwell writes, after visiting the exhibit, "It doesn't bode well that if you enter the Jefferson exhibit not knowing what slavery was, you might come out thinking it was an intensive training program for highly skilled craftsmen." Nevertheless, Edward Rothstein's review in the New York Times is a classic example of the establishment's fourth estate protecting the status quo. Sit down, don't rock the boat. When he actually criticizes the exhibit for stating that Jefferson's Declaration of Independence did not extend life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to African Americans, Native Americans, indentured servants, or women. Rothstein wrote that this pushed too far and that each of those cases needs different qualifications and examinations. They distract from the subject. In his autobiography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, the great social reformer remembers his first thoughts regarding his condition. In fact, his reflections on his own experiences offer an appropriate response to Jefferson's cheerleaders. "Why am I a slave? Why are some people slaves and others masters? Was there ever a time when this was not so? How did the relation commence? Once engaged in the inquiry, I was not very long in finding out the true solutions of the matter. It was not color, but crime, not God, but man, that afforded the true explanation of the existence of slavery. Nor was I long in finding out another important truth, viz., what man can make, man can unmake. Here's another answer for those who like to contextualize about those masters who own, subjugate, and crush other human beings. It's never been considered okay to own another soul, unless, of course, you're modeling yourself after Satan. Remember, this wasn't during the lower Paleolithic period. It was during the so-called Age of Enlightenment. In his essay, Jefferson's Crime, Not Mitigated by the Standards of Time, journalism professor Robert Jensen frames Jefferson's blameworthiness. Certainly Jefferson was familiar with Paine and the arguments against slavery. Certainly Jefferson was aware of the existence of the idea that all humans had an equal claim to liberty and the argument that Africans should be considered human in these matters. Certainly there were many different ideas about the institution of slavery and racism in play at the time. So we're not judging Jefferson by the standards of our time when we point out the way in which he employed racism to justify the barbarism of slavery. We are acknowledging that others in Jefferson's time, including such notable figures as Paine, articulated anti-slavery and anti-racist principles at the same time that Jefferson was, in 1781, writing in his Notes on the State of Virginia about the natural inferiority of blacks. Discussing the night side of Jefferson's legacy in the radio documentary American Icons, Monticello, American artist Myra Kalman suggests, if you want to understand this country and what it means to be optimistic and tragic and wrong and courageous, you need to go to Monticello. Tragic and wrong, for sure. Monticello. Jefferson's neoclassical Virginia brick villa, stoically perches above 5,000 acres of rolling green hills, his plantation once tended to by hundreds of African slaves. From Jefferson's divine resting place, vistas stretch forever, and the Blue Ridge Mountains loom to the west. Monticello is a popular tourist attraction, where Jefferson's slavery component is, for the most part, whitewashed down the hillside where it flows to the Ravana River, which connects to the James River, past other sprawling Virginia estates that should rightly be categorized as America's colonial terrorist camps, also known as plantations. It's as if we've been erased, observed one African-American visitor. The iconic architectural element of Monticello is the dome structure that towers above all else on his celestial home. Many believe that dome to be nothing more than a stately aesthetic element. But factoring in Jefferson's obsession with African slaves, actual testimony from his slaves, and an architectural concept called panopticon, a darker, more deviant purpose emerges. Quote Bob Dylan. All along the watchtower, princes kept the view, while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Lucia Cinder Stanton, Monticello's senior historian, envisions Monticello as a panopticon with Jefferson the all-seeing at the top. He could see everything that was going on. Jefferson's library contained a copy of a book called Panopticon, that outlined a new and controversial prison design that called for circular cells surrounding a central watchtower. Inmates would be unaware if they were being observed. At least two former slaves talk about Jefferson with his telescope, watching enslaved people at work, Stanton reports. So this whole concept of surveillance from his central place on the apex of the mountain came through the oral tradition. He could see out, but nobody could see in. Equipped with his telescope, This warden, in a powdered wig, would gaze down from his heavenly dome, tracking his enslaved labor force on Mulberry Row, or in the fields, or wherever forced labor took them. The enlightened Jefferson kept meticulous records of almost everything associated with his life. Two subjects stand out: vegetables and slaves. Novelist and Professor Jamaica Kincaid, with regard to lettuce, cabbage, carrots, cucumbers, and peas. The garden book has details of the things he planted, the food he planted, but it looks as if it just falls magically at the table. So he'll say, peas were planted. 6 weeks later, peas appear at the table. There's no involvement of labor. There's no soil at all. It's as if it's eaten. It doesn't have any evil in it. But when it comes to the checklist of Negroes owned, as calculated by Jefferson, Kincaid says, the farm book, on the other hand, is all evil. Very similar to his book about peas, corn, beets, and other vegetables, the farm book is a painstaking record of the human beings Jefferson owned. Betty, Martin, Thenia, Critta, Sally, Johnny, Daniel, Molly, and so forth. Sinister? Yes. Evil? Absolutely. More fairy tales about America's founders? Of course. Here's how the Monticello website heralds the bullshit. Monticello was home not only to the Jefferson family, but to workers, black and white, enslaved and free. Workers? Jesus Christ. American bullshit runs deep. Jefferson historian Joseph Ellis underlines Monticello Tom's warped sense of his Teutonic responsibility. Jefferson argued that one of the reasons that he couldn't free his slaves was that once freed, the blacks would intermarry with the whites and would dilute the pure Anglo-Saxon race. Well, he's fathering children by Sally Hemings, and some of them look almost purely white. And again, you get a Faulknerian scene. He's eating dinner, and he's being served by a slave who happens to be his own son. You've been listening to excerpts from Murder, Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, Manifest Destiny, Dreaming of Empire, Book 1. It's written by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. Using Los Niños for a wall. The wail of babies rips like a knife through millions of hearts. Children, scared, alone, torn from their mothers, weep and wail as their families try to enter Fortress America. Families are split asunder as the security states of America handcuff parents and encage children. Decades of demonization of Hispanic immigrants, now married to the hyperbole of a presidential campaign born in criminalization of Mexicans, has led to this chilling, unholy moment. It could lead to nowhere else. Campaigns that trade in fear can only lead to tears. For a foolish, madcap wall, now being used as a bargaining chip, children and infants are reduced to tears. None of us should be surprised. This is the cold face of politics, a politics based on fear of the other, fear of brown faces, fear of an emerging youthful community, while Americans face a declining birth rate and an opioid-addicted suicide rate that surpasses the nation's murder rate. The anxieties of the old causes fear and tears in the hearts of children. We need to tear down France's gift, the Statue of Liberty. It no longer fits the nation we live in, a nation bathed in fear, raised on racist hatreds, truly deserves a wall where their hearts are already shielded behind brick, steel, and barbed wire fences. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour Summer Series. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs broadcast produced out of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation, in partnership with the Center for Research on Globalization. Our shows air on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are airing two presentations from the 2017 Geopolitical Economy Research Group Conference at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. The conference was timed with the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution and therefore chose to explore revolution as a theme. Talks at the weekend-long event covered the widespread and widely varying causes, contexts, conditions, and consequences of modern revolutions as they have expressed themselves around the globe. On this week's program, we'll highlight two of the talks which dealt specifically with the dynamics playing out during and since the October Revolution of 1917 and how they might inform revolutionary projects to come. Our first speaker is Roger Annis. A frequent interview guest on this program, Roger is a Vancouver-based writer, trade union activist, retired aerospace worker, and self-described socialist. He's visited post-earthquake Haiti as well as Ukraine since the 2014 overthrow of President Yanukovych. He is one of the editors of the news and analysis site newcoldwar.org and also publishes his own website, A Socialist in Canada, at the URL rogerannis.com. In his talk, Roger Annis notes misconceptions about the Russian Revolution and its aftermath that seem to divide self-described Marxists and anarchists and others who derive inspiration from it. He indicates that new class alliances need to be forged to tackle the climate change emergency, and he emphasizes revolution and its role in resisting imperial domination. So here is Roger Annis speaking at the University of Manitoba's St. John's College on September 29th, 2017.
My talk deals with thorny questions of how to conduct international solidarity with people who are under attack by imperialism, and how the transition from capitalism to socialism may take place. What are the lessons of the last 100 years of class struggle on this planet since the first great socialist revolution? Not the last by any means, but the first great one that has taken place. So there's really three large reasons why I've come back to this topic in a deeper way than I ever have. One is as a result of the events in Ukraine in the year 2014. Since what I call the Maidan coup, the overthrow of Ukraine's elected president in February of 2014, I have seen a large number of people laying claim to left-wing and Marxist ideas, anarchist ideas. I've seen many people laying claim to adhering to the heritage of the Russian Revolution, fundamental disagreements, they couldn't be deeper, have taken place over the events in Ukraine. In my opinion, it's a pretty straightforward issue in one respect. We've seen a drive by the imperialist countries of the West to weaken and enfeeble the national sovereignty of the Ukrainian people. And they did that by assisting in perpetrating a coup d'etat
in February of 2014 and bringing into power a right-wing anti-Russian government. That's a pretty fundamental thing, and I think we're all familiar with the fallout. Well, it turns out that many people on the global left don't see it that way. Many buy into the idea that Russia intervened aggressively to turn Ukraine into a kind of a puppet state of Russia, and of course the famous annexation of Crimea, which I reject totally as an annexation. I say this was a decision of political self-determination by the Crimean people in March of 2014, which we defended at the time on the new Cold War website. Well, not quite at the time, because the website came a few months later, but we continue to defend. So very fundamental disagreements. I see much of the global left repeating the language of the imperialists to the effect that Russia is an aggressor country, an imperialist country it's called, a country that suppresses the national rights of the Ukrainian people, that illegally annexed Crimea. And it's been shocking to me to see that, because this is so far from reality. And I can't think that this is just the simple misunderstanding that's happened in the year 2014. There's something deep and underlying, because I'm talking about people who lay claim to a political heritage that's more than 100 years old. In the case of Marxists, something like 170 years old. And yet I couldn't be further apart from them on fundamental issues of current world politics. So there's something deeper going on here. It's not just a little misunderstanding over what happened in Ukraine. And I think that what's happened is there's been a drift away over the decades from properly studying and understanding Russia, beginning with what Russia became after the 1917 revolution and then in the Soviet Union under Stalin and his successors, but also continuing with the demise of the Soviet Union and the arrival of the new republics of the Russian Federation, which are now capitalist, or I think more accurately, state capitalist republics, beginning with Russia, but Ukraine, Eastern Europe. We know of the transformations that took place in 1990, 91, 92. And so I think there's been a tendency to find simplistic answers to the complicated questions of why did the Soviet Union demise, and what happened afterwards. And in fact, if you look at the history, what you'll see is there's a swift moving away, not a swift, a rather steady moving away from proper, serious study of the Soviet Union and then the Russian Revolution. It's just not treated very seriously by Western left-wing political analysis, whether it's Marxist, whether it's anarchist, and also not by liberal historical analysis. So there's been a slide away, really, from the Marxist standpoint of the methods of historical materialism in studying and analyzing Russia. So that's the first big reason for me, the events in Ukraine. The second big reason is, as I, like everyone else, you know, become more and more concerned with the global warming emergency. And what I see in the left wing of the environmental movement globally is a real lack of strategic vision. I mean, everyone obviously in the left, and it's now become, I could say, getting close to universal, humanity realizes we're in a global warming emergency. So for the left, then, what is the future society that we need to escape from the emergency? What would an ecological society look like, and how do we get there? What are the class alliances of workers, farmers, indigenous people, middle-class people, even upper-class people, if possible? What are the class alliances that are needed to put the world, the entire planet, on a path to ecological salvation? Because if we don't do that, then the future is very bleak indeed for the human race, very bleak indeed if we don't embark upon that path. So how do we do that? The class alliance, what forms of government are needed in the initial stage that can begin? Because certainly we have very few governments in the world that are committed to a serious tackling of the global warming emergency. And the most basic point is not being made by radical environmentalists, which is that are the current levels of production and consumption on the Earth sustainable or not? And if they're not, how far do we have to go to ratchet down all the waste and excess of the capitalist economic order, which is fundamentally at the root of the global warming emergency? This never-ending cycle of production and consumption and the relentless expansion drive of capitalism, which doesn't know limits. There's no day in the life of a capitalist where he says, I'm happy where I am. I'm not going to go out and try and conquer new territories, exploit more labor, exploit more natural resources. The capitalist system doesn't know how to do that. So what are we faced with then? How radical are the measures that need to be taken in the face of that? And thirdly, we face my third concern in coming to this is we face fundamental issues of socialist transformation in practical terms in parts of the world, especially in Latin America. We have countries that are embarked on a socialist transformation with Venezuela and Bolivia in the lead. We have Cuba, which is miraculously continues to survive, and yet Cuba itself, in its own way, confronts all of the difficulties and challenges that countries on the road to socialism face in the face of the global capitalist, globalist juggernaut. And so how do these relatively small countries deal with globalized capitalism and its huge power? And, you know, there's a question, I mean, to show how flawed my own thinking in all this is, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about China. What is China today? Is China a capitalist country? Is it a state capitalist country? To what degree do the socialist property forms, which undoubtedly came into place after 1949, to what degree do those continue to exist? And how important is that for any thinking left-wing and socialist person in the world to recognize and understand? I'm really, as I think about it, because I attended a session tomorrow, I'm rather humbled, if not embarrassed, by my degree of ignorance of present-day China. And, you know, I'll share some of the blame for that, but I also think that this is another reflection on the state of discussion and political analysis in the world today, which I know is very poor with respect to all of the republics that succeeded the Soviet Union, but I see also quite clearly that's the case with China. China is not on the agenda of the global left at the degree it needs to be for study, analysis, and then political conclusions. Who do we have to work with in China to build the alternative society that we need to confront war and militarism, the global warming emergency, and growing social inequities? There's also the rather important question of whether or not China and whether or not Russia are imperialist. And this is a question that we have spent a lot of time debating from the New Cold War website, because we reject the idea that Russia is an imperialist country. Capitalist, yes. And more accurately, I would say state capitalist. But imperialist, no. It's not. And that has fundamental repercussions. Now, I published an article that this talk is based on, which is Reflections on the Russian Revolution of 1917. And I have print copies here, so I think I have enough for everyone in the room if you want to take one with you. But I go through what I think are some of the key points of significance of the Russian Revolution. Number one, it was simply a gigantic world event. It transformed the world, and it continues to reverberate today. I see the Russian Revolution reverberating when I go to Russia today and look at how Russia functions, its constitutional makeup, all of these questions. So it was the first attempt by the world to build a socialist economy. So the lessons of those decades of attempting to construct a socialist economy were and remain fundamentally important for us. And thirdly, there's a large question of what happened. After all, the Soviet Union did depart from this earth. So where were the flaws in the Soviet Union, in the USSR, that meant that it did not sustain itself in the way, for example, that Cuba has done? Cuba sustained itself for how many years has it been? It's remarkable. 55 years, some crazy figure. How do they do it? I don't know, but they've done it. And Cuba's not the only proof of the viability of socialism in the modern world, but it's sure pretty far up the top of the list. So why Cuba and why not the Soviet Union? Fundamental questions. So these are what I've tried to address in my essay. Now, I think what's fundamentally important to understand about the evolution of the Russian Revolution was just how destructive were the conditions in which it was born. I mean, it's beyond imagination. The first 3 years of terrible, terrible civil war in the early Soviet Republic. Well, Russia became the Soviet Union in 1922, but the early Russian Socialist Republic. These are a couple of maps. This is a better map here that shows how small was the territory that the Russian Revolution came to have in the beginning stage, because all of that white space off to the east of central Russia was the territory of the foreign military intervention, and also the civil war waged by the old Tsarist regime. That's a pretty small part of territory by October of 1919, which was under the control of the new Socialist Republic in Russia.
And there were soldiers from the United States, Canada, Britain, France, Czechoslovakia, Japan. It's got to be 20 countries that invaded the early Soviet Union beginning in 1918, including Canada. 5,000 soldiers from Canada who set sail from Victoria, British Columbia, in order to overthrow the Russian Revolution. So the level of intervention was shocking. U.S. soldiers here marching in Vladivostok in 1918. British soldiers here in the north of Russia, north of Moscow, on the Arctic Ocean shoreline. And then just the level of destruction was incredible. So the revolution did succeed in defending itself through the course of the Civil War. But in 1920, when the Civil War had ended and Russia could now begin to turn to serious task of social construction and reconstruction, this is what they had to work with. And so I think understanding just how much destruction the World War and the Civil War and the foreign intervention caused is fundamental to understanding the difficulties that the early Soviet Republic had. If we don't understand that, then we're really off base in appreciating it. And, of course, the very important last point, which I've highlighted here, which is that expected revolution in Western Europe didn't happen, sadly, tragically. Our previous speaker has talked about Germany in the early years of the 1920s. So this was a huge blow to the early socialist republic, the fact that revolution, that is, solidarity, where Russia's poor and underdeveloped economy could join up with the developed economies of Germany, France, whatever country was successful in overthrowing capitalism like the Russian workers and peasants had done. And then also Russia dealt with a very, very complex population, the nationalities. It's a miracle what the early Russian Revolution accomplished by way of national self-determination of the peoples and nations oppressed during the Tsarist time. I mean, that should be a talk at the next GERG conference, because this is an extremely important experience in the early Soviet Union, which reverberates today. It marks very much the politics of the Russian Federation today and of the different republics that are affiliated to the Russian Federation. But anyway, just to say, another level of complication. So Russia headed in, Russia of the 1920s, and what became the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics in 1922, had three very distinct phases of economic, a political economic development, shall we say. The one that I think is key to studying for today's world is the new economic policy, which came into place after they had succeeded with the Civil War, which is, you know, they inherited a country completely wrecked, and now they could begin to build a new and progressive society. And so, I've highlighted here and don't have time to talk about some of the general outlines of the new economic policy, but the new economic policy was really concerned with two large things. Number one was to incentivize agricultural production, because Russia in the early 1920s was a country that still suffered famine when things didn't go right. And there was a terrible famine in 1921 that killed millions of people, millions, which was really no one's fault. It was what the Civil War bequeathed to them. But this is not a small question in the early Soviet republics. How do we feed the population? And what's the relative weight of resources to agriculture versus industry? Because you can't convince peasants to produce more food if they get nothing in return. You know, they need tractors, they need fertilizer, they need agricultural science, they need health care, they need education for their children. Well, if the Soviet Republic couldn't provide that, well, forget it. People aren't going to... Peasants did produce food during the Civil War years strictly out of moral conviction, that they felt they had something to defend. But, hey, it was time now for some balance to be drawn. And so... And then, of course, the third tragic error. Now, I don't have time. We've only given 20 minutes here. The new economic policy was cut short prematurely. And this was the first disastrous policy under the new Soviet leadership under Stalin, which was to put an end to the new economic policy and then enter into a forced march of industrialization and of forced collectivized agriculture. Those programs were a disaster in their implementation. Millions of people died. And so this is not studied, frankly. This is not studied. This understanding of the tragedy of the
premature ending of the new economic policy. And I really appreciated rereading. I hadn't read it for decades. Stephen Cohen's book, Bukharin and the Bolshevik Revolution. It's a biography of Nikolai Bukharin, where he spends a great deal of time talking about the new economic policy. So there's been an inattention to history, and I fault the movement that I was part of for some of this. I lost my slide. I think the Leon Trotsky and his followers, I think they made some pretty fundamental errors that those of us Marxist historians have to go back to. There was a writing off of the significance of NEP, more or less by 1927. You can read it in The Revolution Betrayed, where you're getting that very strong impression that NEP had run its course by 1927, 28. And, I mean, of course, the left opposition had its own ideas for development. They were very good. They were very good. They weren't... but, no, I think it would be wrong to say that it was correct to put an end to NEP. I find that what comes through in the writings of Trotsky and his followers was an inattention to the critical importance of the Worker-Peasant Alliance. And this is something which Bukharin, really all of them, even Trotsky, understood in their bones. But I think that as the disputes over the new economic policy deepened and became more and more factionalized and more harsh, I think there was an erosion in the understanding of Trotsky and his followers of this critical importance of maintaining, above all, the Worker-Peasant Alliance. Lenin said from the get-go, he said, if we don't retain the Worker-Peasant Alliance, it's over. It doesn't matter what we do. We cannot retain the loyalty of the peasants, not by force, not because we have an army, but by convincing them that their future is better with us than going back to a capitalist order. Then it's over. There was a factionalization of the debate over NEP. All of a sudden, they're all struggling for the same goal. How do we deal with the complications of this NEP policy? And all of a sudden, there's right-wing factions, and there's people accused of wanting a restoration of capitalism. The factionalization of the debate was very wrong. There was the declaration that the concept of socialism in one country was an inherently dead-end discussion is patently wrong. Like it or not, the Soviet Union became a socialism in one country, and it wasn't particularly the kind of socialism that we want to fight or struggle for. Cuba has been kind of a socialism in one country as well. It's just the wrong way of looking at the debate, because there were fundamental issues involved. What happened was not so much that the Soviet leadership declared adherence to the idea of a socialism in one country, but that the Soviet leadership lost confidence in world revolution because of the setbacks in Europe I talked about earlier. So they said, it's just not... We're not going to prioritize that as we did before. We have to step back. And I think very important was Trotsky's formal revival in 1929 of the theory of permanent revolution, it's an imbalanced, it was and remains a very imbalanced way of looking at the tasks of socialist revolution and socialist construction. So I think we have to go back to those years because the lessons of NEP, they stare us in the face when we look today at Venezuela. What's the role of private sector capitalism in the Venezuelan economy? Has the government got the balance where they're right? What about China? As we know, China has immense capitalist investment. What does that signify for China? What are the dangers involved there? Is China still some kind of a socialist republic? That's a very real discussion that has to happen. I submit that many of the lessons from these years are extremely relevant to us. But I also argue quite forcefully that the romanticized interpretations of the Russian Revolution of the 1920s they've worsened over the years by successive generations. The idealization of the years of the Civil War, for example, there was no idealization there. That is something to be avoided at all cost, if at all possible. And so on. So I think that a real rearming of Marxism is required in many fronts, and I think a very important front of that is we have to go back to the early years of the Russian Revolution and confront the misinterpretations and the misconceptions that have been passed down to us over the years, because they don't help us today. It's obviously they don't help us. When we have people who claim the mantle of the Russian Revolution supporting a right-wing coup in Ukraine, and I could talk about Syria, and I could give you lots of examples. Something is flawed in the state of Marxist political theory. I would certainly argue the case also, same case for anarchist theory and liberalism, which has swallowed the anti-Russia propaganda line in the United States like we can't believe. We need a wholesale renewal of all of these political ideologies that are looking, are seriously interested in fighting for a progressive world that we, where we confront global warming, where we confront war and militarism, and where we confront the rising social inequalities. I suggest if we don't aim frankly and outright for a renewal of radical political theories, then we're going to continue to stagnate, as I think we are. And I hope that many more discussions like this, many more conferences like this will put us on that path. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
During the discussion after the talk, Roger Annis concluded with some final remarks.
The left-wing followers of the Russian Revolution, I think, have bequeathed to us, many have, a maximalism in politics, where the interpretation of the Russian Revolution is we want to do the same thing. I'm sorry, I don't want a civil war. I don't want Venezuela to suffer a civil war. I'm glad Haiti hasn't suffered a civil war. We see in Syria where, you know, the politics of maximalism could lead. If that, there's nothing heroic about civil war. Well, there is. I mean, people fought for a great cause, and it was, but it was a curse. It was a curse that they lived with. They knew it was a curse, and they called it that, or some variant of it. The richness of the strategic and tactical sense of the Russian revolutionaries and those who tried to emulate them in those years following is terribly rich for us. The way, for example, in which the new revolutionary government in Russia sought alliances with the anti-imperialist national governments in Asia, Iran, Turkey, China, many, many, profound history. And I see a lot of that in what we need to accomplish in the Middle East today, because the fundamental struggle in the Middle East today is not socialism. It's not socialism. There's no country in the Middle East that's going to be socialist for a while. Let me put it politely. The fundamental struggle is against imperialist intervention. And so anything that aids the national peoples and governments of the Middle East to foil intervention and the attempts to overthrow national governments is profoundly important. And I think the assistance that the Russian government has provided to the Syrian government has been profoundly important for the world. I don't think the Syrian government is faultless in what happened beginning the year 2011. In fact, I very much regret that there's not enough discussion about what were some of the alternative courses that the Assad government in Syria could have taken in 2011-12 to avoid precisely a descent into the hellish civil war that really was imposed on them. They bear some responsibility. Those lessons from the years of the Bolsheviks are extremely important. Meanwhile, in the world today, we have something totally new and different, and that's not even recognized by the global left, or not enough of it, which is that we have two countries to start with, Russia and China, which have become major powers. I used to call China a capitalist country. I'm going to hold off on it. We have, you know, two countries that look a lot like state capitalism to me, that for reasons of history are confronting and standing up to imperialism. Well, that poses a whole new world. And what this does, the Bolsheviks always say, well, this creates openings for people to survive. Countries like Venezuela can survive because they're not dependent on the U.S. anymore exclusively. They can trade with China. They can call on Russia for diplomatic support. And if push comes to shove and there's U.S. intervention, we'll see. We'll see who are the allies of Venezuela who can come to their assistance. Cuba, of course, but Cuba's not going to stand up for the U.S. alone. That's a whole new world. So we need to go back and see how the Bolsheviks rather successfully survived in really worse conditions than what, certainly what Cuba ever faced, what Russia faces today, although the nuclear weapon threat has a whole new dimension. I spoke to Bukharin. I don't think there was a right and wrong side in that. I think everybody was seeking the same goal up until about 1928, and then the whole thing was tossed out the window by what became the government of the Soviet Union. So I don't take sides. And I recommend Bukharin's, Stephen Cohen's biography. It's quite favorable to Bukharin, but I think for very good reasons. But there were lots of problems that were happening in NEP that were not solved. There was inattention, and all sides in fact agreed. Bukharin himself agreed by 1927. So, yeah, we haven't paid enough attention to planning the industrial economy and putting much more priority on forming on a voluntary basis
more cooperative or collective forms of agriculture. So the discussion is, from what we've learned, we've barely begun to learn the real lessons there. And one of the things I think is tragic about NEP is how it all descended into factions. There was a right wing and this and that, and it was, no, everyone was striving for the same goals, and nobody had all of the right answers, and that will be true. That will be true in China today. It'll be true in Russia. Nobody had all the right answers. Nobody in Venezuela has the right answers. It's people got to come together and figure this out, the good and the bad of what's happened with the government in Venezuela in the past 10 years. So I hope that's the kind of legacy that we begin to study now of the Russian Revolution, instead of you know, simplistic repeating of formulas, which, you know, over time they brought out. Like, we're seeing the maximalism with respect to the Russian Revolution of 1917 is becoming right-wing socialism today. It's becoming people that are supporting U.S. intervention in Syria.
We have to finish the well over time.
That was Roger Annis, speaking at the University of Manitoba's Geopolitical Economy Research Group's Revolutions Conference. My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our summer series, we're airing excerpts from the University of Manitoba-based Geopolitical Economy Research Group's Conference on Revolutions, held in the fall of 2017. We just heard from writer and trade union activist Roger Annis. Next, we'll hear from Alan Freeman. Alan Freeman is the Winnipeg-based co-director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group, which put on the weekend conference. He's a former economist at the Greater London Authority and edits the Future of World Capitalism book series at Manchester University Press and the Future of World Capitalism book series with Pluto Press. In his talk, Freeman discussed the topic of parties of revolution. While political parties are often associated with revolution, to what extent do parties create revolutions? And to what extent do revolutions create parties? Here is Alan Freeman, speaking at the University of Manitoba's St. John's College on September 29th, 2017.
The basis of all science is that theory must confront reality.
You're right.
If you have a theory that doesn't explain what you see, what's wrong is not what you see, it's your theory. So I defer to the two speakers who have addressed fundamental issues of what really happened in the German Revolution, what really happened in the Russian Revolution. And that I cannot aspire to do the same. But I'm launching an inquiry into a part of that factual inquiry which has been missed out for a long time, which is the study of parties. I think one of the things that's least understood in the left is, what is a party? Where does a party come from? And the reason is that they replace the discussion of what parties do with a discussion of what parties ought to be. The number of discussions I've heard about the NDP in which the question is asked, is it socialist or not, are 50 times the discussions I've heard about where did Jeremy Corbyn come from. But it's the second question you have to ask, not the first one, because history, as Hegel tells us, is green and theory is grey. So whatever happens is going to exceed our expectations. Does that mean that we approach the study of fact in a theoryless way? I don't agree with that either. And in fact, I think that the only way to study the facts is to try and theorize them. I'm simply saying that if you forget that the facts exist, your argument is actually religious. It's not scientific. Particularly the people who engage in what I call angel socialism on the head of a pin discussions. Is China socialist? Is the NDP socialist? I cannot imagine any more useless question. The question is, what is China? What is the NDP? What are the social democratic parties of today? What are all the parties? And I ask the question, what are parties of revolution? Because I think that that's where all the people I know who wish to study parties come from? They come from weird places, like one of the questions is, am I in a revolutionary party or not? And this is an interesting question, but also, if I can be very provocative, like the question of whether China is socialist, a pretty useless question. Now, I'm going to explain why I think it's a useless question. Because I looked around and I said, what parties in history that have made revolutions have ever put the word revolutionary in their name? None. Not one party in history that had the word revolutionary in its name has ever made a revolution. No party that has emerged from a revolution has ever had the word revolutionary in its name until after the revolution. Very fundamental fact, one we should reflect on. And I began thinking about this by asking the simple question, what is the relation between party and revolution? And I want to pose a very straightforward question. Do revolutionary parties make revolutions, or do revolutions make revolutionary parties? Now, that's a deliberately provocative question, and I'm not going to give you a straightforward answer, you'll be pleased to hear. But all I would say is, can we say it's dialectical? I'm going to explain that by looking at a series of revolutionary events in history and asking what really happened. I think the key is, it's a bit like the question about how many psychoanalysts does it take to change a light bulb, which is that none but the right bulbers really want to change. So the revolutionary party emerges from the revolution, but you always, in every revolution, find a bunch of quite conscious people organizing, often in the most surprising ways. For example, in Castro's army, in the form of the Bolsheviks, in the form of the Young Turks, in the form of the banditry in Mexico, but who have an idea of where they want things to go. When the moment is ripe for the revolution, exactly as Ottokar described, it takes command. So the spontaneous, the old spontaneous organized debate has the answer, you cannot plan for a revolution. You can try, but when it happens, it doesn't take the form you expected. The real key to the success is, one, to know what the potential dynamic of that revolution is, and you always find a group of people who had some understanding of where things were going. And secondly, the recognition of the creations of the revolution. And I'm going to put this again in a quite blunt way. I don't think that the Bolsheviks created the Soviets. The Soviets created the Bolsheviks. There's nothing in Bolshevik theory, except for a few writings of Marx on the role of the communes in the Russian villages, an occasional discussion about smashing the state, and Marx and Engels on the Paris Commune, very important. There's nothing in the Bolshevik legacy where you see them say, what we need is Soviets. But when the Soviets happened, they said, by God, that's it. So that it's the recognition of what the revolution has achieved that defines the party of revolution, much more than the pre-preparation. And the last thing is this counterposition between radicalism and intransigence. The hallmark of a revolutionary party is never, in my opinion, and you can look at every party that's ever made a revolution, the radical nature of its demands. And I'm going to go through this revolution by revolution. Not one of the parties that made revolution advanced the slogan, let us make a revolution in order to achieve socialism. Not one. Not the Russians, not the Chinese. The revolution was the purpose of overthrowing the aristocracy, overthrowing the imperialists, creating a democracy, whatever they did. Then they said, we have to create socialism because that's the only way you can achieve the goals of the revolution. But bread, peace and land is the demand of the Bolsheviks. That's the most wide popular demand you can possibly advance. And then the socialism comes in as the means of achieving it. And the Cubans are perhaps the illustration of the fact that's not a historical relic. Castro did not start with any requirement of socialism. If you read, history will absolve you from top to bottom. There is no mention of socialism. There is no mention of nationalization. There is no mention of expropriation. He was driven to it by what happened, exactly as the process that's driving the Bolivarian Revolution today has imposed itself. So a very fundamental reversal of the way that people think about revolutions is called for. I'm going to go, when did revolution start? Oh, another thing. When you're learning from history, you have to learn from its actors. And one of the things you have to do is take their words at face value. I just think this is incredibly important. If you want to learn what Leninism was, Marxism was, you have to read Marx. If you want to know what Leninism was, you have to read Lenin. You don't go and say, well, you are not really a Leninist, or not, you are not really a Marxist, or not, you are not really a socialist, and therefore I'm going to, you know, my sect will wage your war on your sect. You have to say, let's look at what Lenin said, how much of it is applied, how much was proven by history to be valid, how much was not borne out by history. So, well, was there a revolution before the French Revolution? Yes, there were. There were very important anti-colonial revolutions, and there were things that were not called revolutions, but were called risings. And risings and rebellions have existed. I mean, we know there was a Jewish rising in, what was it, AD BC 63, well, against the Romans. Anybody who watches Monty Python knows that risings are very old. When did they come to be called revolutions? I don't know if anybody knows the origin of the word.
17th century.
No, it is Copernicus' work, De Revolutionis Orbium, on the revolution of the planets. Because it took such a revolution in thinking that it became synonymous with the word for the creation of new forms of government in the anti-monarchic revolutions of the late 17th century. The origin is actually the scientific revolution. So there were risings, there were things that didn't call themselves revolutions that later became called revolutions. The French Revolution is the first one that really took the mantle of that title on. Now, the most interesting thing about that is there was no party of revolution. The Jacobins, actually the term left and right, comes from the place that people sat on the side of Parliament as the revolution was unfolding. So we've inherited a definition of what we think of as left-wing that's defined by what people did, not what they thought. The party then, the Jacobins, became effectively a party, the Montagnards and so on. They were defined by that. But actually it was a process that gave rise to the organised forms in which the division was, do you defend the institutions and gains of the revolution or do you not? The English Revolution, I don't know why that was missing, because that was actually the first one, often called the Civil War. The Glorious Revolution, I think, was the first revolution called a revolution. Actually, it wasn't a revolution at all. It was a sort of minor coup d'etat. The Civil War was the real revolution. Again, no party of revolution, but what there was an army. The new model army was the instrument of revolution. I haven't got time to go into it, but there's an extremely important series of aspects of it. It was in defense of a regime. It was in defense of Parliament against the king. It was formed to defend a definite institution that existed. It didn't say, let's have a Parliament. The parliamentarians formed the army. It was a national professional army because the aristocratic armies would only fight in the locality. And what was needed was an army composed of people who would go and fight anywhere. Unfortunately, that was the birth of modern imperialism because they were perfectly prepared to go and fight in Ireland and the rest of the world and were better than the monarchic armies. But the origin of it is a national army. So revolution in both France and England becomes synonymous with nation. And this is the third thing that I think it's very important to understand, is that the idea of a nationless revolution is a very nice one, but it corresponds to nothing we see in history. All modern revolutions have been national. And in fact, not only that, if we start moving on and looking at the movements of the later 19th and early 20th century, we see that the question of national sovereignty was at the forefront of the revolutionary process, not at the back. It's not, we want socialism and, oh, let's have a nation. It's, we want to have a nation. And the first, and again, in terms of definitions, most interesting case is the Irish Easter Rising, which you'll remember was commended by Lenin as an exemplary revolutionary action. And the demand of the Irish Revolution was very straightforward. To Arthur Griffiths, when he founded the in 1905, Sinn Féin, We Ourselves, to establish in Ireland's capital a national legislature endowed with the moral authority of the Irish nation. That was the goal. Mexico is extraordinarily interesting because the actual party, which is now called the Institutional Revolutionary Party, a wonderful name, a party which ruled for 70 years, wasn't formed until 1929. It was not the party of the revolution. It was formed when Cárdenas insisted that they should take the achievements of the revolution further than national sovereignty by throwing out the United States from its ownership of oil and agriculture and establishing that in order to pursue and accomplish the goals of the Mexican Revolution itself, a social transformation was necessary, the expropriation of the foreign ownership of Mexican land and resources. So the interesting thing is they defined themselves as revolutionary in the sense of saying, we will carry through the demands of the original revolutionaries, just as the Bolivarians are doing today, but we will do it by social means and economic means, not just political means, because you can't complete the political revolution. So without the economic revolution. Now, how long have I got?
6 minutes.
Okay. Turkey, I wanted to say a lot about Turkey and the Republican People's Party, because this defeats, again, any notion. And I think Turkey was an absolutely revolutionary process. You know, it's what basically prevented the imperialist powers from completely carving up the Middle East. And one should never forget that when one's talking about current Turkey. The interesting thing is they did not carry through the social transformation, because they were, you know, resistant to communism, which is one of the reasons for the mess that they're in today, actually, is that, you know, they did not complete the social transformation. But why? Because that made it impossible for them to articulate the national question in such a way that you could have a sovereign government of Turkey which included a number of nationalities. So they completely mixed up the issue of ethnicity and national sovereignty by not defining a multinational polity, whereas the Bolsheviks precisely established from the get-go, both in Russia and in the Soviet Union, the notion of a plurinational polity in which the protection of the rights of national minorities would be a fundamental aspect of the democratic constitution, another part of Russian legacy which is forgotten. And by the way, very interesting question, which great power in the world today is the only great or even secondary power to support the holding of a referendum on Kurdish autonomy? Does anybody know? The only power in the region and the world which has supported the holding of the referendum is Russia. The United States opposed it. Turkey opposed it. Iran opposed it. Assad opposed it. The Russians said you should hold it. Why? Because we defend the territorial sovereignty of Iran, or Syria, or Turkey. But we must know what the Kurds want. So you should hold the referendum. Which I think is an extraordinarily interesting indication of some of the legacy of the thinking of the Russian Revolution. So, plurinationalism. Now, the next thing I want to come on to, and I'm going to have to rush this, is where did we get the modern notion of the Communist Party from? Where did it come from? Where did we have this idea of a single democratic centralist party that doesn't tolerate debate or discussion within it, that imposes from above? And I'm not saying that such parties actually exist, by the way. This is an idea which is defended in China. It doesn't describe what you really see in the Chinese Communist Party as I know it. It certainly doesn't describe the modern Russian Communist Party. And I'm not sure the extent to which it described the old one, but it's a sort of, you know, how can I put it, the most malicious conception of Stalinism that one can possibly have. Well, it's very unclear that such a conception was ever central to what was going on. First of all, many people think of the Bolsheviks as a party. Bolsheviks were never a party. I think at the end of the split in 1912, this is my reading, they said, we are the true RSDLP. They did not say, we are the Bolshevik Party. They kicked out the compromisers and so on and said, right, we choose the mantle of the party. So they said, we are the broad party, but we will accomplish the aims of that broad party by pursuing revolutionary methods by being the most resolute leadership of it. The RSDLP's manifesto, which I read for these purposes, is an extraordinarily long document, and it has, we are for socialism, we are for, you know, overthrowing all the remnants of the bourgeoisie and all the rest of it. The most extraordinary thing is when you look at what they actually proposed when they stood for parliament, the demands are all democratic. I was going to try and read them out. But sovereignty of the people, that is the concentration of supreme state power wholly in the hands of the legislative assembly. That was the first demand of the RSDLP, its founding manifesto. Universal, equal and direct suffrage. Extensive local self-government. Inviolability of personal domicile. Unrestricted freedom of conscience speech. Freedom to travel. Abolition of socialist states. Right of the population to education in their native language. right of self-determination for all nations within the boundaries of the state. This is long before Lenin, by the way. Right of any person to prosecute any official before the jury through the usual channel. Judges to be elected by the people. Replacement of the standing army by universal arming of the people. Separation of church from state. Freedom and compulsory and general and vocational. This is not a social agenda. This is a democratic agenda. But they then followed that with a series of economic demands which were forgotten. They were not at the centre of what was going on in Russia. What was going on in Russia was the fight against Tsarist monarchy and the feudalism and imperialist intervention. It's only afterwards, when it was discovered the only way you could achieve that and go right through, that the issue of the necessity of an immediate social transformation, the immediate nationalisation of the means of production, was posed. The Bolsheviks were perfectly happy to co-run the factories with commissars supervising, workers' control and so on, but the bourgeoisie would not agree to it, which I think is part of, you know, Cuba, exactly the same process. That's what's going on now in Venezuela. So I have to really rush now. The second thing that happened in the history was the 22 points. Now, I haven't got time into 21 points. The purpose of founding the Communist International was to make sure that the internationalization of the Russian Revolution could be achieved by parties that were truly internationalist and communist in all the countries of the world. So the real purpose of the 21 points was to separate out the communists from the social democrats. And I think it's from there. I'm not saying it was wrong. I think it was correct. But history has moved on. The separation of the true internationalists and the true revolutionaries from the centrists and everything is as necessary. But that does not have to take an organizational form. A party of people conforming to the 21 points was the necessity of a specific point in history. It was necessary at that time. I do not believe it to be necessary now. I do not believe it to be a principle of party organization that you have to conform to the 21 points, including democratic centralism and all the rest of it. I'll just put that out there to think about. It was a part of history. The part of history doesn't mean we have to make it part of the present. You have to look at the circumstances. So I was going to talk about Cuba, Iran, Venezuela, but I'm just going to pose questions. What constitutes a revolution? To me, the replacement of the state by a different kind of state is fundamental. Is the party a precondition or an outcome? What's the dialectical relation? What is the precondition? I think the precondition, what defines revolutionaries, is not the radicalism of their demands, but their intransigence in pursuing them. And everywhere you look at the Irish, the Young Turks, the Iranians for that matter, right? Okay, Cuba, the Bolsheviks, you find that the people who came to the fore in the revolutionary process were always the people who said, we really mean it. These are quite simple, democratic, elementary, broad human demands, but we really mean it, and as Malcolm X put it, by any means necessary. And then the last thing is, what does any means necessary mean? It includes war. In every revolution that one studies, there has been a war. As Roger described in great detail, the civil war in Russia, which is a fundamental part of Russian history, which is often forgotten. And Ottokar described the military configuration, the revolt of the soldiers and sailors. So that the old Regis Debray formula, I don't know if people remember that, Revolution dans la Revolution, in which he said Cuba had given the world a new model of revolution because they weren't forming Soviets and so on. Completely wrong. In every revolution, there is a new form of government. The revolutionary wing of the movement is the wing that defends that, the democratic achievements of that. Whatever it is, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, perfect self-governing democracy. In the case of Cuba, it's defending the country against invasion. It's as simple as that. Nothing more, okay? And you have to understand this to understand what's going on in Cuba. It's the defense of such democratic gains as have been achieved by the revolution in itself and its activities. And that means military. There's never been a separation of military and Soviet and forms of government. And I think that's a shibboleth of the Western left, which I'll finish on this, is to believe that it's possible, especially in the modern world as we look at it now with what America's doing, to separate the issue of the form of government, the kind of social measures that are taken, and the military struggle.
Following the talk, Alan Freeman engaged the audience, including a listener, with a query relating to the question of modern revolutions needing to be rooted in national movements. The questioner pointed to the revolutionary situation in Guatemala stemming not from a national movement, but from a regional movement establishing autonomous territory free from corporate exploitation.
I just want to say something on this issue of the autonomous regions, because I think there's a discussion that could be had and it's a non-discussion. The non-discussion would be one side says you have to have a nation state and therefore you can't have autonomous regions. And the other side says you have to have autonomous regions and therefore you can't have a national state. Now, I think that if the Bolsheviks were in power in Guatemala, they would be the most enthusiastic champions of the autonomous regions and the most enthusiastic defenders of the national sovereignty of Guatemala at one and the same time. I mean, the national policy of the Bolsheviks was incredible. There's a book by Shimov, you know, he goes through. They basically took the Austro-Hungarian constitution, the later constitution, which was based on national territories, not beliefs, not religious beliefs, and said, we're going to implement. They would go into villages, you spoke earlier of national renewal, linguistic renewal. They would go into villages where there would be 100 speakers of a single language and declare them an autonomous oblast with the right to speak that language, in which they would even make it the official language and say, no, the Russians have got to learn that minority language, because that's how we will implement local self-government, local self-determination. So I think that a consistent policy would be to absolutely recognize all the rights of the autonomous regions within the framework of the national sovereign state. The second point concerns, I missed something out, which is very fundamental. I think the two characteristics of the revolutionaries are intransigent and mass-based, that they seek to represent the whole of the people, which is why all those parties that, for example, have taken an ethnic stance have never been nationalist. That was the turning point in the CHP in Germany, in Turkey, in my opinion, when they redefine themselves as an ethnic party, right? And I think that the fundamental thing I take from Rogers and others, which is incredibly important, is that what are you really saying when you say the Bolsheviks had to keep the alliance of the proletariat and peasantry? So they had to represent the whole nation, except for the bourgeoisie, except for the people who stand in the way of that, right? Why do you have to represent this whole nation? Because if you don't, you have no democracy. And this, to me, has always been fundamental. I don't understand why people don't get this in relation to Syria. The fundamental division around Syria is that Israel and the US, and until recently Turkey, wanted to partition Syria, and Russia said they must have their territorial integrity. Within that, there is no contradiction from the Russian point of view on having referenda on Kurdish national rights, widest possible self-determination, but the territorial sovereignty is fundamental. Why? How can you possibly have a process that might get rid of Assad, if that's what you want, if it is not democratic? It cannot be democratic if you exclude half the nation from taking part in it. Territorial sovereignty and democracy are indissolubly connected in this day and age. We may move on much later to a new international order when imperialism has been overthrown, where that's not the case. But the nation is what you're given. It's not an ideal. You're stuck with it. If you look at history, look at what revolutions have done. I'm not saying you must make a revolution in a national framework. They have. That's what we've got. And the attempt to, Russia, Tukhachevsky, the attempt to export revolution and invade Poland was a disastrous failure, because the Polish then saw the new socialist country as an invading state. So they were stuck with the national dimension of what they were doing, even though the Soviet Union was a step forward. In a very fundamental historical sense, it's imposed on us by history. And if there's anything I want to say is, you have to stare reality in the face when you're working out what to do.
You said the revolutions that did take place were as a consequence of intransigent demands. And I would like a list of intransigent demands to sort of figure out what kind of intransigent demand we could now impose that could lead to revolution.
That is a very interesting question. But you don't have to look for a demand that you're going to be intransigent on. You say, what do the people need? What do the broadest mass of people need?
What's standing in the way of it? That, and then you're intransigent on that, is the way I would see it.
That was a talk by Alan Freeman, former economist with the Greater London Authority and co-director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group. The talk was presented at the University of Manitoba September 29, 2017, as part of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group's Revolutions Conference. More details about the conference can be found at geopoliticaleconomy.org.